Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
President Bush is expected to attend today's funeral in Atlanta for Coretta Scott King. The wife of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. died last week at the age of 78. After her husband's assassination in 1968, she became known as the keeper of his legacy, and for many, her death marks the passing of an era. To talk about that, we're joined by NPR senior correspondent Juan Williams. Juan, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
No disrespect to the president to say that he's just another name on this guest list for this funeral. Former presidents, members of Congress, civil rights leaders, entertainers, the list goes on and on.
Really is. You know, sometimes, Steve, I think a picture tells a story. And on Saturday in Atlanta, the Georgia governor, Sonny Perdue, and his wife, as well as Atlanta's mayor, Shirley Franklin, stood on the plaza in front of the Georgia State Capitol as a horse-drawn carriage pulled in with Mrs. King's body. Those public officials then embraced all four of the King children. Later, all of the state's major officers, elected officers, and the Supreme Court of the state of Georgia walked past the casket in the Capitol Rotunda. Mrs. King is the first black woman to be so honored by laying in state at the Capitol. 45,000 people walked by on Saturday. As you mentioned, today at the funeral, you're going to have three former presidents, President Carter, President Clinton, the first President Bush. President Bush, the current President Bush, will be speaking. So in a way, I think, Steve, what you see here is a total acceptance and embrace of the Martin Luther King Jr. legacy as the black middle class in the U.S. Progresses into becoming American middle class. I think it's a significant moment in that transition. It's sort of a new black power.
Well, given that progress and that change that you mentioned, how has the civil rights movement changed?
Well, I think it's much more political, as evidenced by that scene. I think you had... It was President Johnson who, after Selma, back in 1965, used the phrase, "We shall overcome," in a speech to the nation about violence against civil rights protesters and asking for support of the Voting Rights Act. And I think that if you think about it, the year after Dr. King died, that would be 69, you had 13 black people in Congress. Today you have 43. You have black mayors, in Detroit, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., even in Waco, Texas, near President Bush's ranch. We've been through two Jesse Jackson campaigns for president. In the last presidential campaign, you had Al Sharpton and Carol Moseley Braun, two black candidates. We've had back-to-back African-American secretaries of state. We have the largest black middle class in the nation's history. So I think the key here, and I think it's important to note, one key here is that although the black constituency in this country is overwhelmingly Democrat, there's no black third party. It's all part of the political mainstream. So I think that you see that the civil rights movement, in that sense, has become part of American politics.
Well, of all the leaders, who speaks for poor African Americans, the kind of people who were brought into the national news by Hurricane Katrina?
That's very good question. I mean, it's right on the target in terms of where we are today. I think, when Dr. King was killed in Memphis, Steve, he was about to launch his Poor People's Campaign, reminding the nation's political elite that, a quarter of all black people live in poverty, which is the case today. And so I think there's a tremendous pressure on black middle class not to separate, black Americans not to separate by class. But poor blacks today, I think, are represented in a sense by Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, even, Louis Farrakhan, because they're the ones who march, protest, boycott incidents of police brutality and racial bias.
Which is something that, that white Americans may not be happy about, but you're telling us that's the reality.
Yeah.
NPR senior correspondent Juan Williams with analysis on the end of an era in the civil rights movement. Juan, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
And by the way, Coretta Scott King recalls key moments in her life in recordings that you can find at NPR.org. Her funeral is today.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, June 2nd, 2017. So I have been told. This is our 10th and final study session on the autobiography of the late Coretta Scott King, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, as told to Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds. As you heard, the audio segment that we started with, that was from NPR in 2006, right at the beginning of the year in January, when Mrs. King died. They have a lot of footage. C-SPAN, they have video footage from some of the memorial services and what have you. You can see former President George W. Bush, amongst others, race soldiers, coming to hang out and being tacky in general, which they often do when a prominent black person transitions, particularly a black person who devoted a lot of time and energy to trying to permanently end racism. So you can go to C-SPAN if you want to see some of the footage and what folks had to say back in 2006. Without further ado, we will go ahead and get started. Again, our final study session on My Life, My Love, My Legacy, the autobiography of Mrs. Coretta Scott King. This is audio segment number one on the context of white supremacy.
Almost immediately upon assuming his role as CEO, Dexter was pitched into a bruising conflict with the National Park Service as Atlanta prepared for the 1996 Summer Olympics. Years earlier, when the International Olympic Committee was considering Atlanta as a possible host city, Andy, who was mayor at the time, insisted that the African delegation visit the King Center and meet with me. Andy told me that they were moved by their visit. When the vote was taken in 1990, the IOC chose Atlanta by a narrow margin. The African delegation's vote was large enough to make the difference, and Andy told me that the delegation's vote had a great deal to do with their visit with me at the King Center and the importance to them of the King legacy. It was common knowledge that Martin's legacy, with its emphasis on goodwill, diversity, and its reputation for racial harmony, was among Atlanta's most powerful magnets, drawing strong global support to Atlanta from the Olympic Board. The city motto, "The city too busy to hate," reminded many of Martin's immemorial words on hate, a way of thinking and living often driven home by Daddy King as well. Moreover, the King Center is one of Atlanta's top tourist sites, bringing millions of dollars annually into the city treasuries. Starting in the early 1990s, the King Center's board and I had been discussing how to finance necessary repairs throughout the King Center campus and expand the center's exhibition space in preparation for the Olympics. It turned out that the National Park Service was also looking for funds for a new visitor center. In initial meetings between me, the Park Service, Ebenezer, and officials from the city of Atlanta, I understood that the Park Service was seeking $12 million from the federal government to build a visitor center, and that the King Center could share in that allocation of funds for our repairs. Also, I believed that the King Center would be given control over the exhibits at the new NPS Visitor Center to ensure the integrity of the narrative, and that there would be space in the center for black businesses to sell their wares during the Olympics. But when the dust had cleared, the King Center did not benefit from any largesse emanating from the Olympics. The Park Service gained precious land and properties. Ebenezer Church received land for a new church as well as significant funds. The city's community center was entirely torn down, and the King Center received nothing at all. In fact, the center lost ground. Dexter once said that the Park Service came in and took everything, just like the government had taken from the Native Americans. While that is not a particularly diplomatic statement, can you blame him for saying it? Before the Olympics, The King District included the community center, a natatorium, Martin's birth home, a few other historic homes, a nursing home, Fire Station 6, where Martin chased fire trucks as a boy, and Ebenezer Baptist Church, which for decades remained the center of worship for King family members. The district also included the King Center, its administration program and archives building, Freedom Hall complex with its auditorium, meeting rooms, bookstore, screening room, International Chapel of All Faiths, and Martin's crypt set in the middle of the reflecting pool near the Eternal Flame. I had lobbied the city and the U.S. Congress for the creation of the Martin Luther King Historic Site and Preservation District. I had raised millions in public and private funds and worked with the city of Atlanta to restore housing in the same block as Martin's birth home. Then, in 1980, at my invitation, the Park Service became involved with the management of the historic district. Because of the nearly 1 million people who visit our site annually, it was impossible for the King Center to be the sole entity responsible for the district's maintenance. We continued to manage and operate the King Center, while the Park Service managed the birth home, the No. 6 fire station, and eventually the Ebenezer Historic Sanctuary and the new Visitor's Center. From the beginning, I had envisioned including all the iconic spiritual institutions in the district, such as Wheat Street Baptist Church and Bethel AME, as well as Ebenezer, along with the Atlanta Life Insurance Building and the SCLC headquarters, but because of insufficient resources, we could not expand. My hope was that others would be inspired to complete the venture. I started our planning for the Olympics with no knowledge of the National Park Service's true agenda, which was hidden from us until it was too late to make a difference. Much of the conflict that bloomed in advance of the 1996 Olympics centered on the community center across the street from the King Center headquarters and Ebenezer. I had raised about $3.5 million to build that center, with the city providing matching funds. I was happy to raise the money because the community center served the Auburn community. It housed a gymnatory, a gymnasium that could also serve as an auditorium that would seat about 1,000 people. The King Center's Early Learning Center, a library, community social services, as well as multi-purpose rooms for activities such as tutoring, and it was just steps away from the natatorium, the beautiful Olympic-sized pool. I saw this center as the city's and the community's portion of the King Memorial. The King Center and the City of Atlanta had agreed that the city would manage the community center and that it would be open for all to use. Initially, the National Park Service had a small office space in a neighborhood home near Martin's birth home. We thought the Park Service would support the community building and development we had already started and would also help by conducting interpretive tours and communicating the mission of the King Center. But what the Park Service really wanted was to purchase the choice land the community center sat on so it could build the Park Service Visitor's Center with exhibition space there. In addition, the Park Service wanted control of historic Ebenezer, where Reverend Joseph Roberts was pastor. The Park Service proposed a land swap by which it would get control of the historic church site adjacent to the King Center through a long-term lease. Reverend Roberts would get cash plus land across the street to build a new church. Dexter and I fought the deal to tear down the community center to make way for the Park Service's Visitor Center. We went to Congress. We went to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. We tried to get the White House involved. I was also excited about Dexter's plan for a high-tech museum named the Dream Center, which he wanted to build on the grounds of the community center. Using the latest technology, this museum would offer the type of sensory effects that allow visitors to feel as if they have been transported back to the major civil rights battlefields and victory celebrations, such as the victory of the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott. For example, in an installation showcasing the Birmingham campaign, you would actually hear the police dogs barking. The centerpiece would show Martin delivering his I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial via holograph, making the whole experience come alive anew. Meanwhile, hoping to win our support for the land swap and the visitor center, the Park Service was initially very friendly. They began a wining and dining process in their attempt to solicit my support. Top officials flew me in a private plane to the Lyndon Johnson Library near Austin, Texas, where I met with Lady Bird Johnson, the former First Lady and Park Service Advisory Board member. She talked passionately about how the Park Service had helped make the Johnson properties one of the nation's most popular tourist sites. The National Park Service had even more aggressive ambitions. The discussions quickly moved to acquiring the land that held my husband's crypt. "That's non-negotiable," was my rather curt reply. Then they talked about acquiring Martin's birth home. Again, I told them emphatically, "That, too, is non-negotiable. We own it. We're going to keep it." I felt and still feel that black people have lost too much land to white people already, and that we certainly should not give up anything else. What I gleaned from these conversations all in all was that the Park Service wanted to buy the King Center. That, too, of course, was not negotiable. Without my knowledge, the Park Service had talked to Reverend Roberts at Ebenezer and with City Hall officials and had also enlisted the help of Reverend John Lewis to push through legislation for funds to tear down the community center. I was disappointed that John Lewis, a movement friend, was not properly briefed on the matter. He later informed us that the Park Service had told his offices that I was on board with the changes, which of course was not true. In the end, after intense negotiations, the City of Atlanta donated the community center property to the Park Service. So the Park Service got the land for its visitor center, which would house Park Service offices and exhibits by the Park Service, and the Park Service worked out a deal with Reverend Roberts for a long-term lease on the Ebenezer Sanctuary in exchange for funds and land to build a new church. The Ebenezer Sanctuary had sacred and historic value. Visitors from all over the world came there to share in a spiritual and historic experience. Four generations of kings had worshipped or preached there. Mama King was murdered there. Martin and A.D. co-pastored and preached at Ebenezer, and their funerals were held there. The idea of ceasing worship service at the original Ebenezer Church was very painful to me. It might have been all right for the Park Service to take that sanctuary years hence, when Christine, Naomi, and I were no longer around and when our children were on their last legs. But to discontinue operating that church in my time, when we had first-generation living heirs, I mean, it is still very painful. This is the first time I have said this publicly. The promises I'd believed the Park Service had made to the King Center to share in the $12 million allocation from Congress evaporated into thin air. Like other entities in the district, the King Center really could have used a facelift, but it did not receive $1 for improvements. The community center was gone. Black businesses who had bought inventory thinking they could exhibit their wares at what was going to be our exhibition site during the Olympics lost their money. Some went into bankruptcy. In future years, the Park Service and my heirs would strike up a better relationship. But what happened then was that Dexter, seeing an injustice being done, tried to rectify it and got maligned, especially in the press. The National Park Service took its concerns to the Atlanta press, which then distorted our intentions. Dexter said he had funders ready to invest the $75 to $100 million necessary to build the Interactive Dream Center. At that time, nothing like that had been done to convey the history of the civil rights movement. But the flap with the Park Service, along with Dexter's consistent statements that James Earl Ray had not killed Martin, which I'll talk more about later on, created such controversy that the funders backed away. When people read negative articles, it created a climate of hostility and ill will which dampened some of the support the center should have received. Cynthia Tucker, the editorial page editor for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, consistently wrote editorials attacking me as well as Dexter and his endeavors regarding the Dream Center. She did it for so long that I sometimes imagined she had some kind of personal problem with us, or that she was being used by others for a broader agenda. I believe also that the funders Dexter had in place were pressured to back away. I suppose that when you become older and wiser, you are more cautious in terms of what you say and the way you say it. I cautioned Dexter about speaking so directly on certain subjects, but he and Bernice have their father's directness. As I shifted into semi-retirement from the center, Dexter and his business partner, Phil Jones, took on the challenge of safeguarding Martin's intellectual property. Their job was to protect his words, ideas, name, and image from literary and commercial exploitation. In one of Dexter's first meetings as head of the King Center, he emphasized the theme of ownership, not just of land, but of ideas and writings, too. As he emphasized in his book, Growing Up King, the King Center is the spiritual and institutional guardian of the King legacy. Our main goal is to educate the public about and to perpetuate and promote my father's message of nonviolence around the world. To achieve this goal, the estate of Martin Luther King Jr. Incorporated must protect Martin's intellectual property, the name, images, writing, and speeches that embody his message. Land is the real estate of the past, Dexter said. Intellectual property is the real estate of the now. If you stand back and let others steal Dad's material, then you are affecting every minority writer, every songwriter, every composer, every artist, every storyteller, every creative person. It's well known that Martin did not live a lavish lifestyle. He gave away much of what he earned in his lifetime, including the $54,000 he received in connection with the Nobel Peace Prize. He left hardly any inheritance. It was our family friend, Harry Belafonte, who took out an insurance policy on Martin and helped obtain other contributions that aided our family in the years after Martin's death. However, Martin did make clear a distinction between the income he derived from his work as head of the SCLC and that from his personal efforts as a private citizen. He believed that his spiritual message belonged to the world, but his copyrighted words belonged to him legally in life and to his children and me after his death. This is why, as early as 1955, he began copywriting his speeches and writings, including his 1963 I Have a Dream speech, and doing so under his name rather than under the names of organizations he represented. With no land or no material possessions to leave to his heirs, Martin knew that all he had to leave behind was his intellectual property. Soon after he delivered I Have a Dream, which is widely considered one of the most important speeches of the 20th century, 20th Century Fox Records started mass distribution of the piece in its entirety without Martin's permission. At that time, many people had not heard the whole speech, and 20th Century Fox took advantage of this fact, selling and profiting from Martin's words without paying him a dime. Martin sued to stop distribution of the record on the grounds of copyright infringement, and won. In the 20th century, millions of acres of land, especially in the South, were stolen from blacks, leaving their heirs impoverished. History repeated itself when record companies sold lyrics blacks had penned and or sung, while giving them little or no compensation. Why should ideas and land alike be lost to blacks while the great wealth they create goes to enrich others? This historical understanding is, no doubt, why Martin gave the rights to distribute his I Have a Dream speech to Berry Gordy, founder of Motown Records. In 1999, the estate of Martin Luther King Jr., Inc. sued CBS News on virtually the same issue that Martin had advanced with regard to 20th Century Fox, copyright infringement. The network had included footage of virtually the entire Dream speech, along with several of Martin's most revered speeches, in a five-part series, and then sold the footage on home videos. They did not give the series away. They sold it for profit. They used my husband's words, name, image, and speeches to make this money. But Martin's heirs received nothing. It was unfair. And a court of law upheld this conclusion, ruling that the copyright laws protected Martin's speeches. Spending millions fighting copyright infringement was something we had to do to protect the integrity of Martin's legacy for future generations, not to make ourselves richer. While we won the courts, CBS's venerable 60 Minutes program tried to sully our reputation by running a critical piece entitled Selling the Dream. It basically accused our family of using intellectual property as a means of profiteering from Martin's work. Its argument did not make sense in court, nor did it make sense in the court of public opinion. My son also appropriately pointed out in his book, Growing Up King, that during the trial, it was revealed that the network charged schools and nonprofits $1,000 per minute to use its footage of the I Have a Dream speech. In cases large and small, we must safeguard Martin's legacy, his name, image, and words for future generations. To whom should we render this vital responsibility? Corporate America? The federal government? Once again, legal trials have brought clarity and have protected the dignity that is rightfully attached to Martin's name. In the early 1980s, for example, a novelty company began manufacturing a miniature bust of Martin, claiming it was doing so in conjunction with the King Center. This was tasteless and disrespectful, a good example of why we must protect Martin's image as well as his words. If we do not call out these violations and try to put a stop to them, our silence could be viewed as acceptance. With this in mind, before the formation of the estate of Martin Luther King Jr. Incorporated, the King Center sued the manufacturer of the bust. A Georgia court upheld our right to protect Martin's image and stopped distribution of the sculpture. The law maintains, however, that it is the responsibility of the interested or potentially aggrieved parties to police how their intellectual property is being used, or their ability to prevent others from exploiting it will be compromised. Although the King Center brought that suit, it is now the King estate that bears the burden of ensuring that Martin's words or images are not used pornographically, indecently, or in ways incongruous to the values he presented to the world. To carry out this mission, the King Estate frequently issues licenses to businesses and individuals who use Martin's name or likeness for profit. When the use is by nonprofit groups or schools using the material for educational purposes, there is generally not a charge, or there's a nominal charge. Yet, in both the CBS and miniature bust cases, negative publicity against the King family continues to obscure the principles for which we are fighting. Much of this negativity emanates from Atlanta, a fact of life that dogged Martin and continues to hound my family today. I think perhaps this negativity will stalk the King family in perpetuity, although it is my hope and prayer that it will one day cease. Sadly, even my husband often felt alienated in his own city, the place where he grew up. For instance, when he tried to establish a campaign around school desegregation, he called the city leadership together and outlined his proposal. But he couldn't get leadership to come together. There were about 20 potential leader types, all vying for attention. So Martin forgot about Atlanta and moved on to other campaigns. This kind of situation my children and I still deal with. Too many people saw me just as Mrs. King and assumed I was riding on the coattails of my husband's notoriety. They did not see Coretta, who had gifts, talents, and ideas, as well as a passion to carry out Martin's mission for all people. They saw Mrs. King, but not Coretta, who had four children to care for, and a husband who was often looked at as the president of Black America, but who depended on me as his soulmate, wife, and primary confidant. Even before Martin's death, I was asked to join just about every progressive women's group and organization of color in the United States and expected to attend regular meetings. If I didn't, I'd face the buzz that I was too high and mighty to relate to real people. For example, when we moved to Atlanta, Martin encouraged me to join the Lynx chapter there. The Lynx is a public service organization of mostly middle-class Black women. It does many worthwhile community projects. Members are asked to call and explain their absence if they can't attend a meeting or event. When we lived in Montgomery, I belonged to the Lynx there and was actively involved in that chapter. When I joined the Lynx in Atlanta, sometimes I was so busy taking care of my kids and my husband, or I was traveling for the movement, that I just plain forgot to call in my absences. Quickly, it came back to me that I was being whispered about, referred to as Miss It or Miss Hot Stuff, who thought herself too busy to call. One day, after I had rushed Martin to the airport and was trying to explain why I'd forgotten a meeting, one of the Lynx leaders said to me snidely, "Well, why don't you just try to come to one meeting a year instead of two?" Stung, I decided that this was just not an organization I could be a part of. I did end up being a member of the National Lynx organization instead, which didn't require me to be subject to time-consuming rules or dues. All the children seem to have inherited specific qualities from Martin and me. Yolanda has our love of the performing arts and a sense of how to balance difficult situations. Martin has his father's name, as well as his zeal for advocacy and social justice. Bernice possesses a deeply rooted spirituality and a strong zeal for advancing God's kingdom. And Dexter has an astonishing resemblance to Martin, as well as the tenacity that Martin and I shared. 22. I will count it all joy. In my heart, I know what killed Martin. Hate killed him, just as hate killed President John F. Kennedy and Senator Bobby Kennedy. Only love and the sincerest pursuit of justice can heal the wounds laid bare by the assassination of three of the best and brightest among us. For if Martin, John, and Bobby can be killed, how can we ever rest in peace? If Martin, John, and Bobby could not be saved, if causes, both large and small, can be settled by shadow agencies, conspiracies, and covert operations, doesn't this put our nation at terrible risk? If bullets are substituted for ballots, how can we believe that democracy in America is not in jeopardy? Such actions should be unthinkable in a country that has seen so many of its men and women shed their blood to speak noble words in aid of equally noble results. One thing has long haunted me since April 4, 1968. I believe that James Earl Ray was not my husband's assassin, and that the U.S. government had a hand in my husband's death. On August 27, 1998, I met with U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno. I asked her to open an investigation that would finally bring all of the facts about my husband's death to the forefront. There are a lot of Americans, me and my family included, who continue to believe Martin's murder was the result of a conspiracy involving the U.S. government. This is why, personally, it's hard for me to believe that President Lyndon Johnson himself was not involved somehow, either directly or indirectly. I was so disappointed when the statement Janet Reno issued promised only a limited investigation. How could you do a partial investigation? That is nothing. I had no illusions that anything would come from such a half effort. I did, however, get a measure of justice. On December 8, 1999, in a civil suit I filed in Memphis on behalf of my family, a jury of 6 whites and 6 blacks implicated U.S. government agencies in the wrongful death of my husband. The extensive evidence presented during the trial convinced the jury that my husband had been the victim of assassination by a conspiracy involving the Memphis Police Department, as well as local, state, and federal government agencies, including military intelligence, movement insiders, and the mafia. The jury affirmed the trial's evidence, which identified someone else, not James Earl Ray, as the shooter, and agreed that Mr. Ray had been set up to take the blame, something we had maintained all along. We requested a mere $100 in restitution to show that we were not pursuing the case for financial gain, but for the revelation of truth. The jury's findings and conclusion were monumental. But what is absolutely amazing to me is that no more than a handful of reporters covered this trial from start to finish. The findings of the jury should have been published in their entirety by every major news source in America. It is not an overstatement to say that this was the trial of the century rather than that of O.J. Simpson, which I understand about 2,000 reporters covered. The mainstream media basically ignored the sworn testimony of former law enforcement agents and other persons who were direct witnesses at the time of my husband's assassination. Most Americans do not know that a jury found that their own government was party to a conspiracy to end my husband's life. I have had 30 years to reflect on April 4, 1968, the day I felt my heart ripped apart, and I have not talked about this in much detail. But I feel more comfortable talking about it now, after that jury decision. If such a crime and cover-up can happen to a man of my husband's stature, with no consequences, it could happen again. And I want everyone to be aware of what we know. From the witnesses who testified at the court proceedings in 1999, my son Dexter and I pieced together the following account. It stands in stark contrast to the official reports, which concluded that James Earl Ray acted alone. Thursday, April 4, 1968, is a date that still torments Memphis Detective Ed Reddit and Fireman Floyd Newsom, the only two blacks assigned to provide security for my husband's stay in Memphis. According to their testimony, both Reddit and Newsom were supposed to be working out of fire station number 2 that night, directly across the street from the Lorraine Motel at 422 and a half South Main Street, where Martin was slain. The fire station's location made it ideal for surveillance. It was built on an embankment that raised it high above the street, affording it an eye-level view of, among other things, the hotel's second-floor balcony. But after comparing notes in the aftermath of the assassination, Reddit and Newsom learned that both of them had been pulled off the detail that night, ensuring that they would be nowhere near my husband when the shot was fired. On Wednesday night, April 3rd, Newsom had gone to hear my husband speak. When he returned home at 10:30 p.m., he received a message telling him not to go to fire station number 2 the next day. He was directed to another location, ostensibly because of a problem with understaffing. When he reported for duty at the other station, number 31, however, he found not understaffing, but overstaffing. In fact, his assignment there meant that another man had to be detailed out. For years, Newsom wondered if events would have taken a different turn if only he had been at fire station number 2. No doubt Reddit similarly thought, if only I had been there. On April 4th, Reddit was at his post in charge of stationary security for my husband. He was invaluable to this assignment. From his years of experience in town, Reddit knew everybody, from the invaders, a black youth group, to the Klansmen, from ministers to militants. He was also such a loyal follower of my husband that he called himself one of Martin's disciples. On the morning of April 4th, Reddit was surprised to learn that the King detail had been cut from 10 people to 2. He and his partner were it. Reddit testified that about 2 hours before the shot was fired, he received a call from his boss, Frank Holloman, director of the Memphis Police and Fire Department, telling him to report to headquarters. He told Holloman he was reluctant to leave his post, but he had to follow orders. When he arrived, he was taken into a conference room. Holloman identified one of the people in the room as a Secret Service agent and told Reddit that the agent had come from Washington to Memphis to warn Reddit that there was a contract out on his life. Why would a Secret Service agent, whose job is primarily to guard the president and his family, be concerned with a lowly Memphis detective? Even if there was concern, why would an agent come personally? Reddit was told that until the danger passed, he and his family were going to be moved to a safe location for their own protection. Reddit strenuously objected, but was overruled. Several police officers escorted him to his home. Once there, he heard over the radio that Dr. King had been shot. With Newsom and Reddit out of the way, who did see what happened? By the time the state presented its case, a man named Charles Stevens, a resident of the rooming house from which the fatal shot was allegedly fired, our family maintains that the shot came from the bushes, had become one of the state's most important witnesses. There were no fingerprints from James Earl Ray in the rooming house, nor was there evidence to prove that Ray's rifle fired the bullet that struck Martin. But there was Charles Stevens' eyewitness testimony. Initially, he said he saw a very short, slightly built man run past his door, though James Earl Ray was 5'10" and well-built. Meanwhile, at about 4 p.m., 2 hours before the shot was fired, a yellow cab driver was dispatched to 422½ South Main to pick up a fare, who turned out to be Charles Stevens, who was reportedly so drunk, so intoxicated, that he couldn't get off his bed. The cabbie refused to transport the drunken Stevens, returned to his cab, and drove away. Shortly after the shooting, when reporters tried to question Stevens, they found him in jail, being held for his own protection, according to some accounts, and to improve his memory, according to others. On the morning of April 3rd, Lloyd Jowers, owner of Jim's Grill, which was across the street from the Lorraine Motel, received from a man who was going by the name Raoul the rifle that would be used in the assassination of my husband. In the court transcripts, Jowers says he put the rifle in a box under the counter. He said that he had been given $100,000 by a man with mafia connections to help provide a cover for the shooting, for which a patsy would be provided. A few minutes after 6:01 p.m., when Martin was shot, Jowers took the gun, which was still smoking, from the shooter and hid it back under the counter. It was picked up the next morning by the shooter, a man Jowers went on to identify as a police officer. In late 1990s, Don Wilson, an FBI agent working in the Atlanta Bureau, told me that immediately after the shot was fired, he watched FBI agents laugh and joke about the murder of my husband. Wilson, now retired, was the agent who searched James Earl Ray's car, which was found at an Atlanta housing project several days after Martin was assassinated. In it, he found pieces of a handwritten note with the name Raoul written on it. My lasting wish is that an open investigation into my husband's death will be carried out by a national commission modeled after the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission to break down this wall of state secrecy about my husband's murder and follow up on the evidence put forward at the civil trial. Some 600,000 pages of government records and files relating to the surveillance and murder of Martin exist. These files must be made fully available to the public, either by being released in full, without review, or with the appointment of an independent civilian review board to oversee the release process. This investigation and process should provide immunity for those who are willing to come forward and finally lay out all the facts pertinent to the truth of who killed my dearly beloved Martin. truth, crushed to earth, shall rise again. My husband said that many times. My lasting wish is that this truth, too, shall rise. Truth, equality, fairness, justice. These are the causes to which I've tirelessly dedicated myself. But in the thick of these pursuits, there would come a point where I would make some serious lifestyle changes. First, in the late 1980s and early 90s, my parents were declining and needed more attention, and this turned out to be one of the most challenging times of my life. At first, Edith, Obie, and I thought our mother was just showing ordinary signs of senility. But in 1988, we learned that she was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. On some of my visits, I recall that she would put on a sweater and get her purse and say, "I need to go home. My parents are looking for me. My parents are worried about me." I would tell her, "You are already home. This is Coretta, your daughter." But I wasn't able to reassure her. Around 1990, I moved her from Alabama to Atlanta to my home for a few months. Then, when she began to need more care than I could provide at the house, I moved her to a nursing home associated with Georgia Baptist Hospital near the King Center, where it would be easy for me to visit her. As her health declined, I would sometimes sleep at that facility with her. On some occasions, Laura Brown would stay in my stead. Later, I moved her to a different home, one associated with Emory University, so that she could receive the around-the-clock care she needed. Some friends helped me with the expenditures. I tried to pamper her. I threw parties for her. I visited her practically every day. Although my family provided some support, I hired caregivers to attend to my mother 24/7. I could have been comforted even more by visits from my pastors and members of my church, but it just didn't happen. This was a very lonely and extremely difficult time for me. It was not easy, but neither was it a burden. I was often sad as I faced the reality that I was losing my parents, but I also found joy in being there for them. They had always been there for me. My mother passed in February 1996, a few weeks after her 92nd birthday. Dad kept on working at his general store way into his early 90s, until I decided to intervene and stop him because he was becoming frail and not as mentally sharp. Many customers were taking advantage of his weakened state, cheating him. In 1998, after a brief stay in the hospital, he died in his sleep on the Sunday before Thanksgiving. He was 99 years old. After my parents passed, there came a point when I needed to slow down to take care of myself and my health. Following in the footsteps of my son Dexter, I became a vegan. In those years, when I spent so much time visiting my mother at the nursing home, I started getting stiff, very stiff, in my legs and my knees. I could hardly get up and down. Dexter said, "Mother, you know your body is breaking down. You're too young to allow yourself to do that." He is a vegetarian and follows a holistic regimen, and he thought I should try it. At first, I eliminated red meat, except I was still eating barbecue. But eventually, I found a nutritionist. I worked with her for a year, and she started me on a raw food diet, about 80% raw food. I gave up meat, and I don't miss it. Dexter also introduced me to blue-green algae, a sea vegetable packed with nutrients. Once I turned from relying on prescription drugs to using alternative medicines, a more holistic approach that includes exercise together with a vegan diet, I began to feel much better, and I have a higher level of energy. I use a mini trampoline for exercise. I raise my heels up and act like I'm jogging, but I don't go very high up off the trampoline because that would be a little bit too much for me. I'm also into reflexology treatments, which I get from a massage therapist. I underwent a major lifestyle adjustment, and I enjoy talking about it. In 2004, it was finally time to leave the home I shared with Martin and my children. I moved into a spacious condo more than 30 floors up, with a glorious view morning and night that Oprah Winfrey had obtained for me quietly, without fanfare. I enjoy being able to wake up every morning and open my blinds and look out over the city, and in the evening, I love watching the beautiful sunset. My friendships also have nourished my soul and been a source of comfort and delight for me throughout my life, and especially in my later years. One of the highlights was my Girls' Weekends with Merle Evers and Betty Shabazz. We met occasionally in one of the nicer Florida health spas on the pretext of losing weight and eating healthy. Very seldom did we achieve our goals, but oh, what fun we had together. During our outings, at least one of us would usually wear a disguise, a long wig, sunglasses. One particular trip in May 1997 stands out in my mind. Ingrid Jones, a close friend and then vice president of Coca-Cola, generously covered the costs, and we stayed at the Doral Country Club and Spa in Florida near Miami Beach. Merle arrived first, so excited. She knew how to swim, so she stayed in the pool until Betty and I arrived. When we were together, the three of us rarely talked about our status as widows, although this was the initial bond that brought us together. Merle's husband, Medgar, an NAACP field director, was murdered in front of their home in Jackson, Mississippi on June 12, 1963, reportedly by a white Klansman. A black member of the Nation of Islam murdered Betty's husband, Malcolm X, on February 21, 1965, and Martin was murdered on April 4, 1968. Our experiences were so deeply ingrained in our individual consciousness that there was no need to speak of them. To do so would have been like talking about the air inside our suite, the grass outside our door, the sky above. They were an ever-present given. So it was liberating at times to be oblivious. We were not Mrs. King, Mrs. Shabazz, or Mrs. Evers, just Coretta, Betty, and Merle. At the Doral, basketball had our attention. The Bulls were playing. We screamed, we hollered. It didn't matter who won. That wasn't what we came for. We came to enjoy not being in charge of anything. We came because we loved one another unconditionally, despite negative news reports of how we'd tried to upstage or jealously compete with one another over the limelight. Imagine that anyone would actually want to rise to prominence on the basis of losing the man she loved. When you can relax, let your hair down, and share your secrets. That's real friendship. At the end of our trip in May 1997, we took care to schedule our next girls' getaway. None of us could have imagined that a tragic turn would upset our plans. A week after our trip, I received a call letting me know that Betty had been the victim of a fire. She'd suffered burns on more than 80% of her body and was in intensive care at Jacoby Medical Center in the Bronx. I dropped everything and prepared to go to the hospital, hoping and praying that even with such severe burns, Betty, my dear, fun, kind friend, would live. I could not accept the fact that something like this could happen. I kept hoping that her condition had been exaggerated. The idea of going to the hospital seemed unbearable. I called the poet and writer Maya Angelou, another close friend, and broke the news. Maya was very emotional, but said she would meet us at Jacoby. I called Bernice, who insisted upon flying to New York with me, along with my devoted special assistant, Kelvin Lynn Cothran, to see Betty. When we reached the Jacoby Medical Center, we could tell that Betty's daughters had been crying. The visibly distraught hospital administrator and PR person drew us aside. They tried to prepare us for what we were about to experience. "You will not be able to identify her," they told us grimly. Of course, Betty's six daughters, Atala, Ilyasa, Kibala, Malika, Malak, and Gamala, knew who she was. We all knew who she was. Yet we could not reconcile that image with the severely injured woman we would be seeing. Yolanda, who was already in New York, soon joined us at the hospital. Philip Mott, my cousin who lived in New York, and Maya, Bernice, Yolanda, and my assistant Lynn and I labored to collect ourselves before entering Betty's room. We needed strength, and I asked Bernice to pray for us. As expected, she rose to the occasion. She really is a prayer warrior. Her prayers lifted our spirits, and we braced ourselves. Before we entered Betty's room, we had to put on masks, sterile hospital gowns, paper slippers, and head coverings. When we entered the room with one of Betty's daughters, we found that Betty's entire body had been wrapped in a heavy gauze-like material. Only a slit exposed her eyes and mouth. Through our tears, we all managed to talk to her, hoping she was still able to listen. We told her how much we loved her and how we were praying God would heal her. We felt that she heard us and left feeling sure she would make it. When we came out of the room, we felt uplifted. Although Betty never said a word, she must have been responding in some way. The doctor, who had given her no chance, started to express hope that she might progress after skin grafts. Over the next few weeks, her doctors performed 5 skin replacement surgeries. However, sadly, on June 23, 1997, Betty made her transition. She died 32 years and 4 months after Malcolm X. Losing her was so hard. If anything could have made the situation worse, it was the revelation that it was her and Malcolm's 12-year-old grandson, Malcolm Shabazz, who had set the fire in her home in Yonkers, New York. He told the police he was not trying to hurt his grandmother, that he was only trying to create a situation that would force him to be sent home to his mother, Kubila, in Texas.
Context of White Supremacy. That is the first audio segment. We will pick up. We are kind of in closer to the, I guess, middle part of chapter 22. I will count it all joy. We're kind of in the middle portion there, so that's what we'll pick up at for the second audio segment. If folks have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to chime in, you want to share your views, but you are not able to call in, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. The address, if you need it, is tiny.tiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.tiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you enter that address, look on the left of the page. You'll see the link. It says Free Vote Line. Click that. It will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Code 564-943-pound. Excuse me. The code 564-943. You'll see that on the next line. Just make sure you don't press pound. 564-943. And then the final line, you'll see where it says name. You can enter a nickname, real name. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. It's the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. We'll get you on the line. Glad to hear your thoughts. Again, this is our last session. We'll be starting a new book next week. Again, I'm thinking we should do Gil Scott Heron's autobiography, because he also talks about his contribution to the King holiday in addition to his own childhood, how he became an entertainer. I'm a big Gil Scott Heron fan. If other folks have other choices, feel free, let us know. But this is focusing on My Life, My Love, My Legacy. Folks have any comments, thoughts, concluding analysis on the text, if you dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Took some notes. I'll start off with number one. White people are capable of compromising efforts to solve white supremacy and use these efforts to endorse and refine the practice of white supremacy. The King Center becomes a symbol rather than a tool and or weapon that is destroying white supremacy. There's plenty of examples of it in this book of how they have, you know, used the King Center. Any suspected or white supremacists around the world, they come to the state of Georgia, they come to Atlanta. Oh, you know, you got to go to the King Center now. You got to make sure you go to the King Center and be taken and take pictures with Mrs. King or the children or, you know, one or the other, that sort of thing. And that becomes a very additional standard for that white person or that group. Also, in other examples, hell, Malcolm X is on a doggone stamp, you know. So number two, I have down here just right on Mrs. King when she was talking about with a lot of these white supremacists who wanted the land in the area that about certain things in her opinion were non-negotiable. That is a common practice by white people, is to gobble up our bodies as well as the ground that we stand on as much as possible, or for their own basic strategy to maintain white supremacy and move us around. Number three, typical strategy used by racists, pitting non-whites against other non-white people to maintain white supremacy. You know, with that, with the land, the different issues, they would tell you one thing and tell the other non-white person something different, and you know, the communication is not very good, so therefore you would have a double whammy, you know, to whereas that white person would get what they want, at the same time they would create adversaries out of people who used to be allies. Number four I have here, ultimately they can take everything. To follow up on what I just said, I have here, ultimately they can take everything from you. But they rather, instead of be so obvious about it, they'd rather use deceit as opposed to force. That's always the better strategy to use. And oftentimes it actually works. Number five, the King family has been attempting to protect Dr. King's writings, recordings, etc. You know, for a very long time. You know, for a very long time. I recall there was some of that over the movie Selma. We all know about the speech that he made at the Capitol steps, and that it was some fight. I remember some fighting over that. I didn't watch the movie, but I don't think his actual voice was entering at all during the whole movie, from what I've heard. Number six, by the 1980s, the image of Martin Luther King was safe enough for the white supremacists to exploit basically everywhere around the world. It was pretty safe for them to be able to do that. It became a cachet image more so than anything. Number seven, Janet Reno if someone would want to know, was a longtime Miami-Dade state attorney. She was a longtime Miami-Dade state attorney before she was promoted by William Clinton. She was the state attorney during the 1980 rebellion that took place down here. Also, the Elian Gonzalez incident that went national. Also, she was the state attorney at the time. And just a bit of history for anybody who doesn't know to know that. Number eight, white supremacy is structured to the point that the truth will not be revealed. And I'm talking about Dr. King's assassination. You know, there's so many variables involved. And as the reading stated, Mrs. King got involved with all the children, of course. You know, I mean, I couldn't say that anything would be different if I was, you know, one of my parents was dealt with in that fashion, that I wouldn't be, you know, involved in it also. But the truth would not be revealed during the global system of racist white supremacy. Anyway, number nine, I put down here, great job, Mrs. King, on making decision for proper eating. That's always a good thing, and that's one of the four things that non-white people need to be doing on a daily basis. Number 10, because of the climate, a lot of well-known black people stay or visit on the beach, what is called the beach. We're talking about Miami Beach, you know, and that's been going on for a very long time, even before urban week that is down here on Memorial Day. It normally ends in a lot of black people getting shot or mistreated in some kind of way, or mistreating each other down here. One more. I have down here, Mrs. Shabazz's death was horrific. Her grandson, as we all know, Malcolm, started the fire. Me, as being a retired firefighter, I've seen a lot of results of fire to people's bodies, and that's a very horrific way of transitioning. And I just hope that and pray that her pain wasn't as severe that I think it was at the time. And that's all I have to say for right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, questions to ask, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Just a few things here. The story of the Park Service's land grab, very interesting, typical use of gentrification against non-white black people by using the weapons of lies, deceits, payoffs, you know, whatever they have to do to in order to grab a piece of land that a bunch of black people are on or black people own. So and it also kind of like, you know, gentrification to me now is like the new colonial, you know, ism now. So it's basically, you know, it also pits a lot of people against each other. I think a retired firefighter mentioned that in his commentary, you know, and this is why, you know, non-white black people, we have to keep the lines of communications open to each other when white people, you know, express lies to us about, you know, about other black folks. So it's something that, you know, we have to always keep in mind. You know, it's so funny while we were talking about the, one of the record companies were trying to, use, Martin Luther King's speech, for, you know, for a profit. You know, I was thinking about some of the other fights, black artists, you know, going back to like when Chuck Berry had to sue the Beach Boys for using his music, you know, all the way up to a couple of years ago when Marvin Gaye had to sue Robin Thicke, Marvin Gaye's family had to sue Robin Thicke about using his music, and also thinking about Prince, because it's like, you know, white people love to use, you know, our music, you know, our art, you know, for their financial gain. And then when we come back and try to sue them, you know, they try to demonize them and say, oh, you know, why are you doing this? You know, it's supposed to be for everybody. But yeah, so I thought about that when CBS was 60 Minutes ran that piece on how they were accusing the King family of doing, you know, of using intellectual property, you know, for financial gain. The interesting thing about that trial she mentioned in regards to the trial that she had, the civil suit that she had filed in regards to the death of her husband and the government, you know, involved conspiracy in it. It was interesting how she expressed that, because I remember during that time hearing about it, but it was really not on any, or it may have gotten like 10 seconds of coverage on all of the major news sites. So I remember noticing that back then in 1999 and was, you know, kind of, you know, shaking my head about it, because it's like, you know, a court ruled that the government, you know, assassinated Martin Luther King, the, you know, a person, you know, so-called reveres in this country. So I thought that was interesting. Also, as a retired fighter said, big ups to Mrs. King in regards to changing her eating habits, but also to her outing with the other wives, Betty Shabazz and Merle Evers. You know, I think you know, women, you know, under that type of stress, you know, do need to have a day together, and not necessarily to discuss, you know, the problems of the world. Just get out and relax. I mean, we're in the system of white supremacy. We have to, you know, we're owed something to relax. So, you know, because the stress of it will, you know, would just basically tear you apart, you know, if you don't at least, you know, step back for a second, you know, to relax for yourself. So that's all I have for now, in my life.
Appreciate that. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you'd like to share, we haven't heard from you. Line should be open. Feel free. Oh, my goodness. Before I forget, Robin Thicke was mentioned. My gosh. Other folks we haven't heard from, proceed.
Is it loud? I'm kind of in an environment that has music in the background, but can you all hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. I'll try to speak directly into the mic as to prevent the music from filtering through, but a couple of things that I had taken away from the reading. When Gus says all the time that he hears the word trauma, or he associates the word trauma with this particular book, I also I see confusion to the same degree. So how trauma would lead to confusion in Black people, that I think that's one of the things that white people know. They know that if we're psychologically confused and traumatized, that it's very hard for us to think clear. So I appreciate all the work that Ms. King has put in and all that she's contributed. But I think some of her early traumas, and then with some of the positive reinforcements that followed, like the white boy that she dated or some nice white person she thought she met, opened up the room for there to be space to have nice white people, which I think leads to confusion. And that's one of the things that I was thinking about, that the subtle difference, like if she and Ms. Shabazz and Ms. Evers were able to all be together and spend time together, being bonded over having had their husbands murdered, but even still, like with the differences in philosophies and so forth, I think it would have been really nice to see what they would have done together. I mean, just being able to have a friend, I think, is important too. Not necessarily like you have to be doing something like develop an organization or something like that. But the final thing I wanted to say is that I feel like it's really important that we develop inclusion about white people. That's one of the things that I think that if Dr. King had done, and didn't leave room for there to be so-called nice white people, that things, their work, their efforts, their energy would have been much more transformational for non-white, specifically black people. I think that just leaving any room for there to be so-called nice white people really just weakens the movement, so to speak. With that, thank you all for listening.
Indeed, appreciate that. I mean, other folks that are with us, if you have a hand up, line should be open. We miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that we haven't heard from? Oh, we'll check
have
back.
Have you heard?
Oh, yes, sir.
Oh, greetings, everybody. Greetings, the host. This is the Voice 305 out of Florida. Very, very good read. I really appreciate this part of the book because it started to go into details of some information that, you know, pretty much new to me. And some details I knew that was just more refined into information. So I did want to talk about how, when she says, Dexter also introduced me to the blue-green algae, sea vegetable packed with nutrients once I found and relied on prescription drugs to use in alternative medicine. And then she switched out and she said, I began to feel much better and have a high level of energy. And it just, you know, I just thought about how everybody who has been switching their diet lately and taking better care of themselves aren't on the system that's designed for us to be in that population control, which is a lot of this cancerous type food. So I was just talking to my cousin earlier about that, and we were exchanging, you know, natural products and stuff like that, that eventually, you know, made us feel better. The energy, I take something called black seed oil, and, you know, everybody that followed Dr. Sebi and felt like their health has been better. I mean, it's just so good to just, you know that we are taking better health and are more health conscious with ourselves. And that to me was like pretty much highlight moment in the book. And that's it for now. I'm doing my line.
Outstanding. Ashe, Dr. Sebi, passed away last year. For other folks dialed in that we have not heard from, anybody else that we've missed completely, caller at 6900. Did you have commentary?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings, Gus, callers and listeners, Jay out of New York. Just wanted to follow up. I'm kind of happy we're at this final place. I haven't been able to dial in the last couple of book study sessions, but this was an interesting chapter. A couple of things I just wanted to point out. One of the times when she had mentioned about the deaths of Martin, JFK and Bobby Kennedy, and she pointed out those three individuals, especially, of course, her husband, but still bringing up the Bobby Kennedy and JFK, even at the point where she's realized that the government was involved in the assassination of Martin, and knowing that, you know, Bobby Kennedy was involved within the government at that time, and when she was being bugged, and JFK was still involved, and all of that, they were still prominent in her mind to kind of talk about the losses that she experienced in this fight. So that stood out to me, and kind of to point out what Emmy said, I think reading this made me kind of up my counter-racist game to say that there is no good white folks, because I think that was the search that she continued looking for those individuals. But even when you look at a situation that she was put in, and all the deaths that she had throughout her life. I mean, the family members on top of family members, and the three people that she mentioned was Martin, Bobby Kennedy, and John F. Kennedy. Really stuck out my mind when I kind of read that. Also, when she talked about when they were, I guess, doing the civil suit, that she didn't want any monetary return from it because she didn't want anybody else to think that they were trying to go after money. Now, for someone whose family's house has been bombed time and time again, her dad's family, like houses, businesses, I would say to myself, I wouldn't really care about what anybody would think, that we were trying to leave some type of financial legacy for the family, knowing that they're trying to take the, you know, King Center and everything else, that you would try to get as much funding to give back to your family as possible. But again, I think it's just the mentality of, you know, still trying to appease to a group of people that still just kind of harpened, you know, the movement. And you know, it's a learning lesson. We're all victims. But for me, it was good information to read, because even someone who has gone through that level of trauma still was out there looking for that. So that's all I kind of had for this this section. Thanks. I'll meet my line.
Appreciate that, sir. Anybody else, if you have commentary, feel free. We should have a good bit of time before we get to the second audio segment. Some of the notes that stood out, I guess I would get in first and foremost, if folks want any additional reading material on the assassination of Dr. King and the conclusion that James Earl Ray did not do this. William Pepper, he was a guest on the program. He's a white man, suspected racist. He is an attorney who worked on this case, on the very trial that was mentioned in the book, in fact. He was on the program, and he talked about his research on the assassination. He's written several books. I think he even has a newer book as well. I know 404 was asking me to get him back on the program to discuss his newer book. And then even the infamous Dick Gregory, he co-authored with Mark Lane the book Murder in Memphis, which gives a lot more detail that this was not James Earl Ray, and a lot of the information that she put forward, Mrs. King, in the book that we covered this week, and even the fact that this trial was not covered. So that's two bits of information. William Pepper written about it, and has been a guest on the program, and then Murder in Memphis by Mark Lane and Dick Gregory. Going back to the text, things that stood out, where she starts this week, where she's talking about the Olympics and how she had hoped that could be a great opportunity and the King Center could be involved and all that. Man, pretty much every time when they have these white sporting events, if it's the Olympics, if it's the World Cup, really, even if they're talking about a professional team bringing some sort of, you know, professional franchise, it does not benefit black people. I wouldn't care what they said, that this is going to, you know, bring new schools, new houses, business opportunities, whatever they say. A gold brick is going to fall out of the sky when we, you know, do the Olympics here. It'll be great. It's not going to help black people. If anything, you can look at Atlanta. They went and knocked down Techwood Homes, a whole lot of black people. And she went through a whole lot of the details. Sometimes they'll lie. And, oh, yeah, we'll involve the King Center. It'll be great. You all will be able to come and sell your merchandise. And then they do it the exact opposite thing. Sometimes they just tell you up front, you niggas are gone. They did the same thing in 2012 when they had the Olympics in London. There was a housing, it was a huge skyrise apartment building, many, many floors. And it was predominantly black people. The BBC, for their press coverage, they took over this building. So the people who lived there, they couldn't even access their property for long stretches of time because the BBC, it was so important to have, you know, adequate press coverage of these white games, the Olympics, that they were inconvenienced. And then they were talking about, you know, having the BBC either purchase the place or knock it down or whatever, that this was going to be an omen of bad things to come for these mostly dark residents at this building. We talked about the same thing with Brazil last year when it was down there. Standard operating procedure. When she says, we thought the Park Service would support the community building and development we had already started and would also help by conducting interpretive tours and communicating the mission of the King Center. And then she goes on, she says, but what the Park Service really wanted was to purchase the choice land the community center sat on so it could build the Park Service Visitors Center. That it just reminded me, it seems like once again, Mrs. King being naive, and this is all of us, Gus T. Renegade, we are not the experts on racism. I even said that that might be a question that I begin to ask white guests or anybody really, but particularly white people, when they say that white people are more confused about racism. What do you make of Mrs. King confessing in her autobiography that she and her husband were naive about racism? What do you make of that if black people are the experts? But it seems like with this park situation and the Olympics, it seems like, again, just not being aware. And some of it could be trying, you know, the whole nonviolence and the Christianity and wanting to see the best of white people, and they can be cured. That could be some of it. It could just be, you know, we are just still learning. We just haven't come to an adequate understanding of what racism is, how it works, what it means to be white. But some of the same errors and how this whole situation was dealt with. I did think the portion where she was talking about, I guess, her own plans for the King Center and her son Dexter. He was, you know, good with technology, and they were going to have this, theater experience where you could go back and hear the march, and you could experience the bus boycott and the dogs. Like, I don't know. I think they have such simulations now. I've been to the King Center. I've seen some of the, it's not the sort of thing, in my view, that's going to help us get to solving the problem. As opposed to that, we much more need the mechanics of what racism is, how it works, what it means to be white. And even, I think they were using the term celebrate. Yeah, she says, you'd be transported back to the major civil rights battlefields and victory celebrations. We don't have victory celebrations until white supremacy has been permanently eradicated. Moving forward, let's see some of the other things that stood out. Let's see. Yeah, where she says, without my knowledge, the Park Service had talked with Reverend Roberts at Ebenezer and with City Hall officials, and had also enlisted the help of Representative John Lewis to push through legislation for funds to tear down the community center. I was disappointed that John Lewis, a movement friend, was not properly briefed on the matter. He later informed us that the Park Service had told his office that I was on board with the changes, which was, of course, not true. They got a variety of methods of making this thing work out. We can master deceivers. We can go and confuse this black person. We can go and lie to them and give them incorrect information. We can go and do this. We can wine and dine you. She talked about that when she was talking about Lady Bird Johnson, former President Lyndon Johnson's wife, when they were with the Park Service and they were trying to finagle her out of the King Center and all this land. We can be not, we get private jet, no problem. All kinds of newfangled technology, whatever you like. Or we can lie, or we can just be brutal with it. You know, we can be gangsters about it. Variety of different ways. And exactly as Firefighter said, generally we like to do it where at least it has the veneer of everything was on the up and up and you were on board and we didn't do anything deceitful. But at the end of the day, we can't just be gangsters about it and, you know, proceed. Let's see, what else? Yeah, I thought they do this sort of thing all the time where they'll have all these promises about urban renewal and this project is going to be great and it's going to restore places where black people are. And she says the community center was gone. Black businesses who had bought inventory thinking they could exhibit their wares at what was going to be our exhibition site during the Olympics lost their money. Some went into bankruptcy. Black business. We just had workplace racism yesterday. This is what I think about when people talk about all you got to do is be a black entrepreneur and that'll solve your problems. It will not. When Mr. Fuller says being a black entrepreneur is like opening up a lemonade stand or whatever your business is on a slave ship, this is what happens. You can be a black entrepreneur and then racists will go do something like this and just waiting around the corner to sabotage whatever your enterprise is. They are phenomenal at that. Not saying not to go in business, just make sure we're not thinking incorrectly that if you go into business for yourself, you will avoid racism. Let's see. And I thought the whole taking of this land and everything, the desecration of black burial sites and places, geographic locations that are important, significant to black people, and just being able to come and erase those. I think the Atlanta, or it's the Braves, not the Falcons. I think the Atlanta Braves, I think they just got a brand new sports stadium and they had to tear down one of the oldest churches, oldest black churches in the city of Atlanta. I think this is recent, like within the last year, standard operating procedure within the system of white supremacy.
Woof, the portion where she started talking about how they fought back in the local papers, the part where she says she would be attacked in the papers when people read negative articles, it creates a climate of hostility and ill will, which dampens some of the support. Some of the support the center should have received. Cynthia Tucker, who is a black female, the editorial page editor for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, consistently wrote editorials attacking me as well as Dexter and his endeavors regarding the Dream Center. She did it for so long that I sometimes imagined she had some kind of personal problem with us or that she was being used by others for a broader agenda. I believe also that the funders Dexter had in place were pressured to back away. Really important all the way through this whole passage. It reminded me of John Patash. He was a guest on the program twice. We discussed his book, The FBI's War Against Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, and then Drugs as a Weapon Against Us. And in both books, he talks about how one of the ways that COINTELPRO and these covert white supremacist operations, one of the ways that they work is that you have journalist sources. Either you have out and out people who write for major publications like the New York Times, Life, I suspect the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, whatever else it is. You have people either that are also employed to work at these papers so that they can write whatever you want, or even though this person or you don't have someone at the paper, you're able to write things and then you can just get them attributed to somebody. Ghostwriting, they call it. You can just write up being it can be an agency, the FBI, the CIA, whatever white supremacy enforcement agency or official. But they can write up whatever they want. And then we just give it to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the New York Times, whatever it is. We give it to them. They publish it. We put this person's name on it. We might even put a black person's name on it, like Cynthia Tucker. We'll put somebody's name on it. And there we go. He talked extensively. That is one of the effective, dangerous, major ways that COINTELPRO white supremacy operations were operate. That came to mind when I read that passage. I did some checking because I wasn't sure if Cynthia Tucker was a black person or not, just when I was reading the text and I'd never heard of her before. She won the National Black Journalists Association. She won their award for Journalist of the Year a few years back in the 2000s. And then the New York Times, they did a piece where they were talking about how the King family felt pushed aside by Park Service, the whole piece that we just read about in the book. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but this is a sentence, or a few paragraphs. This is from December of 1994. It reads, the family also struck back at a local newspaper columnist who had criticized their opposition to the Park Service plan and accused the family of profiteering on the dream and legacy of Dr. King. Mr. King said they were doing no more than any other family in charging modest fees for the reproduction of the civil rights leader's words, adding, even the word of God costs money down at the religious bookstore. But it was Mrs. King, flanked by her children and supporters, who struck the most indignant tone, rebutting recent articles by Cynthia Tucker, editorial page editor of the Atlanta Constitution, that criticized Mrs. King and the center she founded in 1968. This is all not even for a moment. Had personal enrichment been a goal of me or my children, said Mrs. King, perpetuating the memory and ideas of her husband, Mrs. King said, was a sacred responsibility and legacy born of tragedy. It was not something we wanted, but it was also not something we will turn away from. It seems that the same evil forces that killed Martin Luther King are now trying to destroy his family, end quote. I don't know what's indignant about that phrase. That is curious wording. At least to me, everything that she said there seems valid to me. I can see why she and her family would be sensitive about accusations that they're just trying to get money. If you repeatedly have whites for years and years and years taking video footage or speeches of Dr. King while he was alive and or deceased, taking his work and reproducing it and not giving a dime to the family or asking permission or anything, I can totally see how they would, you know, be sensitive about charges when you have to repeatedly fight against this. And then when you do it, they accuse, oh, man, you're just trying to get money. You're just trying to get something. And so then when they go and they try to get information about who assassinated their husband, and they have to say that from the beginning, like, we're not trying to get any money. This is about getting the truth, because you keep getting accused of that all the time. I can understand how you would be sensitive to that charge. But the whole paper thing, fascinating, racist. They are phenomenal. It seems like there's been a lot of that for the entirety of Dr. King's life, her life, just having people that are in the press that are either racist themselves or doing the work of racists to smear and talk bad about black people and increase conflict with other black people. They got it best when the journalist is a black person, because then it's still just non-white people in conflict with each other, attention not being focused on racists. Let's see. Anything else I wanted to make sure? Let's see. In the final, in chapter 22, right at the beginning of chapter 22, when she starts in about Robert Kennedy and John F. Kennedy and comparing them to her husband, the same sort of white identification that I think we've referenced repeatedly in the text. I don't know if that's like a selling point to get maybe white readers to get the book, or to not alienate white readers so that they feel included. This is a part of their story. It certainly seems like this was authentic to her view of racism, that all-inclusive racial reconciliation, that's what she talked about, racial harmony, promoting that at the King Center and not being about anything that vilifies white people, what have you. So it certainly seems authentic and consistent with what's been presented, what I know about both Mrs. King and her late husband. But exactly to what Emmy said, I think when you have this sort of perspective, this is a major part of why we have not been able to solve the problem of racism. I wish there had been maybe even earlier attention on the assassination and her belief that James Earl Ray did not assassinate Dr. King, because that is widely propagated. I think very few people know about the trial and subsequent books and literature about the trial in the 90s that implicated the government, including military intelligence, in the assassination of Dr. King. I would have much rather heard about that than what a fink Jesse Jackson is, or, you know, some of the other things that we've heard after the assassination of Dr. King, and what cool people got to stop by the King Center, and what cool people we got to see around the world and in Europe. I would have much rather heard more about this. Again, there are books on this if, you know, you want to read more in detail, but I think that's way more important. And I think that's something that has been deliberately suppressed from public attention. Because all of that's really important in terms of the massive involvement in what she's saying, the fact that they had a trial where they came to a conclusion about this, a verdict about this. I mean, wow, that's the system of racism, white supremacy on display right there on all levels, and the massive amount of resources that white people can dedicate to neutralizing, killing just one black person. All of this was not to go out and get the entire SCLC. One black person warrants all these resources and all these different agencies coordinating, orchestrating their activities. Let's see. And I thought her information about diet and being healthier, I thought that was massively important as well. Racists do so much to work against that, and particularly with all the trauma she has experienced. It's unimaginable. I was thinking when she was talking about the passing of her parents that she only lived about a decade or so after her father transitioned. It seemed like they lived so long, and it seemed like it could have potentially seems like she could have had the genetic material to live a even longer life. But the amount of trauma that she had to experience, I think Dr. Kamban and many others, Ishaka Musa Barashango, have talked about black racists. Whites, they rob us of so much. When you have black people who die at the age of, like we're talking Prince, people dying in their 50s, Michael Jackson and Prince and Gwen Ifill dying in her 60s, even Dr. Welsing, that we should be living way longer and living with tremendous health, where we're not struggling and being stiff like she was talking about when, you know, before she made some diet changes. We should have tremendous health, and they've robbed us of so much. But that kind of stood out to me. And then the relationships that she talked about with Medgar Evers, the widow of Medgar Evers, Merle Evers, and then Dr. Betty Shabazz, widow of Minister Malcolm X. Thought that was really important. I think we had mentioned them before. And I'd said that I thought that was going to come up in the book. I didn't know it was going to be almost at the conclusion, but I did think that that was going to come up in the book. And again, same type of thing, I think, where racists have done it. She talked about it, trying to make it seem like they didn't get along and they were squabbling over who got more attention and that sort of thing. Just absurd. And just to say again, that's one of the reasons I think it's so important that we put that first and foremost, making an effort with other non-white people to reduce, minimize conflict with other black people, making that one of our top priorities. I will pause there. Any folks that we missed completely who have commentary, they would like to share, the caller at 4243. You should be with us, that you have commentary. Caller
4243. I'm sorry. This is Red from Ohio. I was just going to say, I'm just going to wait until the next segment because I missed the last one. That's all.
Yes, ma'am. No worries there. Any of the other folks that are with us have commentary that they want to share, or folks just listening in?
That haven't had an opportunity yet, or?
Oh, yeah. If you have additional comments, feel free, retired firefighter, feel free.
Yes, I was just thinking with the advent of the, I believe of the 96 Olympic Games, going back to the early 70s, and I got all of this, I got this information, I learned it anyway from the Eyes on the Prize series, that first black mayor, I believe his name was Maynard Jackson, he had an excellent program to whereas with his mayoral authority was employing black people that in order for you to build anything in the city of Atlanta, you had to have a percentage of black people who also contracted to help build the facilities. And it was plenty of them that was going up during that time. And it really angered the wealthy white people who controlled the city of Atlanta. Actually, they even called him a racist. They actually called this non-white victim a racist, a racist at the time. Black people even had the contract to build large parts of that airport, which is one of the largest airports in the world. But in turn, the area that was known for business in Atlanta for black people, it started deteriorating. It started deteriorating at the time. And I think also those wealthy white people put that Olympic Games on black Atlanta also, with the advent of showing black people a lot of money. There's a lot of historical colleges within the city of Atlanta, in and around the city of Atlanta. And a lot of them got monies for it to spruce up their athletic facilities. But one place in particular, one college in particular, Morris Brown University, actually, as I heard you say, they actually suffered from it. If you didn't know about Morris Brown, in the movie Drumline, the university that represented in the purple, I think purple and gold, that's actually was the former Morris Brown University. It actually went bankrupt, I think. They lost their accreditation, you know, that sort of thing. And the area that used to be that famous street where a lot of black-owned businesses were at during that time, it's almost collapsed totally due to the Olympic Games and a lot of the things that was going on at the time. In the city of Atlanta. So it's kind of like whatever was considered to be quote unquote black wealth is absorbed into the city itself to almost nothing. But connected with South Florida, a lot of the black people that grew up in my generation, they ended up migrating into the Atlanta area. In terms of from the standpoint of the white people who speak Spanish, grew to a large level to whereas just about everything is in charge down here. So all of that, I just mentioned all that to say on how that connects up with what Mrs. King was explaining in and around during that time in the 1990s, during the Olympic Games that was in the city of Atlanta, how all of that, its connection that is expanded to see the deterioration of non-white people and their investments and or, you know, money is concerned. That's it for right now. Thank you.
Yeah, I remember when I was in Atlanta, Morris Brown was right about at the end when they were closing down and everything. But yeah, the Olympics did not help black people in Atlanta at all. Just you can want to start up a conversation. You catch any black people that are older that lived there, who were there before the Olympics and, you know, have remained there since, can be a great conversation piece if you catch them in a coffee shop.
What's the name of that famous street? I just can't think of the name of where all those black-owned businesses used to be at when Atlanta was, quote-unquote, segregated.
Trying to think. See, would it be Auburn or...
Auburn, that's it. That's it. That's it. That's it. Auburn. Auburn Avenue. With a symbolic image of black proficiency in business at the time. And I don't even think it exists at all now. I haven't been in that area in several years, but I don't think it even exists now at all.
I haven't been in Atlanta in a number of years, but when I was last there, Auburn was not the mecca of black business, not by a long shot,
right.
In the city of Atlanta. Other folks have commented, even if you already spoke, just if you're with us, did you have any other comments you wanted to get in before we get to the second audio segment?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening again. This is The Voice. I like the fact that she highlighted a point kind of secretly, but kind of for us to try to catch it. It's where she says, it's such a crime and a cover-up that could happen to the man of my husband's status with no consequences. It could happen again, and I want everybody to be aware, and she wants them to know. And, you know, like she stated, the assassination of Dr. King had happened, and he's such a man of great stature, and then you have all these killings of different individuals that's being killed out here, and there's no consequences, no repercussions, so it's just going on and just repeating and repeating. So I thought that was a good point that she pointed out, that, you know, if something like that happened to somebody that caliber, then somebody who is not of that caliber is pretty much going to be swept under the rug from beginning to end. So also, you hit on the point, Gus, with the, I was going to say about the women, how they all got together, and she stated, you know, when she was with the other women, how it rejoiced and rejuvenated her soul to be around her friends. And also she stated at a point where, it is in the book where she says, when you can relax and let your hair down and share your secrets, that's real friendship. And I try to, you know, when I'm out here in the streets to converse with females, and let them know that, you know, you have to stop watching these programs that, you know, white supremacy puts out on TV, like the Love and Hip Hop, the fights, the constant bickering and not being able to love each other. And that type of image, it actually transcends on into the workplace, because I've posted an article where ever since these shows started to appear on TV where females, black females going at other black females, and just being violent and cursing, that type of display on TV, when you have these non-black people in HR positions, that when they watch these programs, they think that that's how black women act. They're very confrontational. They're very violent. And in the report, they did a survey and have stats that 52% of Black women in the workforce have not been getting jobs due to those negative image that they see. So I thought it was real good that you highlighted it, and I also had highlighted it that, you know, the more and more Black women, you know, can get together and show each other love, you can see it just transcends in their energy, their health, and everything like that, and they can prosper better. And even with the gentleman, we could do the same thing ourselves, and I think we'll live a better life within ourselves and have more of a unification and code. But that's about it for now. I'll move my line.
Also wanted to make sure I got in as well the Black self-respect for the explicit commentary, and that's the second time at least that that's come up in the book, where she's talked about Black people owning land, and she spoke with a lot of pride, as she should have, about her Black relatives and family members in Alabama and the Scott family, and the amount of Alabama land that her family still owned. And it sounded like this was, you know, current in the 2000s, and that seemed like the same mindset that she had about the property that they owned in Atlanta, and, you know, non-negotiable. It's no discussion. It's not for sale. It's mine, and that's that. Like a great illustration of Black self-respect, right on, Mrs. King. And also, Julian Bond. I've said before, I took class. The late Julian Bond. He passed, I believe, it was 2014. I think, if memory is correct. I took a class on the Civil Rights Movement, and he talked about the King Center, and I guess them allowing reprints and quotes and what have you from the King speech, and it seemed that he had the opinion that the fees that they charged were excessive. I remember him, you know, making a bone about that in class, like he felt, you know, he gave examples of other speeches and what have you that are quoted for like academic purposes, and he said that he felt the fees were above and beyond what the normal fee would be for quoting or what have you, using something for academic purposes, and that kind of flew in the spirit of Dr. King and what he was about, obviously, as someone who Julian Bond and SNCC who worked with them and all that. But he didn't say anything nasty about any of the King family or her. He just felt like that the fee at the time was a bit on the high side. But her explanation in the book, at least to me, was very lucid in talking about Dr. King giving away the money that he won for the Nobel Peace Prize and just living a very meager existence. I think some people did note the contradiction about the traveling last week. It seemed like they did take a good number of trips to Jamaica and what have you. But yeah, I did. I appreciated the explanation that she gave. I didn't have a problem with that at all in safeguarding his work, and particularly with white racist poachers coming in repeatedly to make these recordings and just try to infringe on his work. Did anybody have any other comments on that or anything else?
Oh, one more thing about the adulation that she seems to have for the Kennedys. It reminds me of if you would go into a non-white Black person's home, which I did as a paper boy back in the 70s, as well as a firefighter in the 80s and the 90s, and you know, you would, well, especially in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s, you would see in a lot of Black people's homes pictures of the two Kennedy brothers. The Kennedy family were experts. I'm talking about super experts on exploiting the conditions of Black people for their political purposes. They were highly successful with that. Mrs. King, even she mentioned it early in some of the earlier readings, to whereas in my mind, I think she feels internally grateful for what at that time the candidate for president did for her own anxiety, her fear, based on the terror that was taking place with her family and her husband. at the time. And, you know, the thing about it, it's not even that much, it wasn't even much of a work for them, because by that time, even in the Kennedy family's, that was like just, you know, like going to Publix and buying an orange. It was so easy to do. You know, I guess white people in the past before that really didn't really concern themselves about that type of strategy, not knowing how deceitful, powerful it was at the time. Now it's kind of like something that it's like more consistent now that everybody, all these white people are doing it now, you know, taking advantage of us in that way. But they were like trendsetters. I would say probably earlier, it may have been the Roosevelts, because Eleanor Roosevelt had a long-term relationship with Mary McLeod Bethune. But the Kennedys, whew, I mean, that it's not unusual, especially with those two brothers. And by the advent of them getting assassinated, that just made it even more. It kind of like deemed them as gods. And if Caroline Kennedy right now today walked into a black church, I swear the whole church would shut down, and I guess people would be wiping her feet, kissing her toes, and whatnot, as far as they're concerned. So it's not unusual. It's not unusual. I put all that to say, it's not unusual on what she was expressing in this past reading on the subject of the Kennedys. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Just thinking about what the retired firefighter just said about, especially about the Kennedys, it seems like, I'm not really trying to get off topic, but just to try to translate it into my mind, because I'm fairly young. I'm somewhat young, and I'm not that familiar with the Kennedys and that type of love, but it seems like the Clintons, for my day and age, are kind of like the Kennedys, and it kind of makes you think about how the mothers of the movement have been used by the Clintons, and almost makes you think like maybe they're somewhat supposed to be the new transplant of Mrs. Coretta Scott King. That's
great example. Great example. Great example.
Thank you.
Clintons were mentioned in the book. She had accolades for them as well, even though she did call Slick Willie out for the drug program and the incarceration of black people, but she did seem to think that he got a lot of poor people, got them to a better position. That was a couple weeks ago. I also wanted to make sure I got in really quick. I thought that was a really important point. The listener said there seemed to be reverence for like the government, and certainly reverence for a lot of individual white government officials, Jimmy Carter, a little bit for Bill Clinton, the Kennedys, Robert and John F. There seems to be quite a bit of reverence for different government officials. I'm sure I've even forgotten some. When she talks about the government assassination, absolutely. It's white people like some of the very folks that she mentioned who were participating. And at least I know I emphasized Robert Kennedy authorized some of the illegal surveillance activity, COINTELPRO operations that were happening. He was attorney general during a good chunk of the time. He was attorney general when the March on Washington happened, when her husband was doing his activities and what have you. So I thought that was extremely important. And I think that is a huge problem that a lot of times we will, when people use terms like the government or institutional racism, even when they say racism is a system, all of this is white people. When they say the government, the functional government on the planet is the system of white supremacy. And that is racist man, racist woman, racist child. Somehow that there seems to be a pattern where victims of racism, and it could just come down to trauma and terrorism, really, at the end of the day, and just being fearful of indicting white people, because we know what happens when you do that sort of thing. When you upset white people, you can end up like Dr. King. But I thought that was really important. Just wanted to emphasize what the listener said before. Any final comment before we get to the final audio segment, or are folks satisfied? You can save it for after the second audio clip if you have anything else to add. So we are picking up. We're in chapter 22, and we're kind of at the break point, I guess, where it's right after Dr. Betty Shabazz transitioned. So it's the sentence should be, while I'm speaking of personal matters such as friendship. That's what we're picking up at in chapter 22. Without further ado, final segment on the autobiography of Mrs. Coretta Scott King, My Life, My Love, My Legacy. Context, the White Supremacy audio segment number 2.
While I am speaking of personal matters such as friendship, people always want to know if I dated other men after Martin died, or if I ever thought about remarrying. I've also been asked why my two daughters are thus unmarried. As for me, I have had dates, but no serious marriage proposals. One of my very good friends since our days at Antioch, Dr. Lonnie MacDonald, a psychiatrist, and I would go see operas and plays together. When I was a UN delegate living in New York, we would take long walks together. I also dated McHenry Boatwright, a bass baritone concert singer whom I met when we were both students at the New England Conservatory of Music. McHenry was a nice person with a beautiful voice, a great musician who also played the piano. He sang at the White House during the Carter administration. He tried his best to take me out shortly after Martin died. While I did go out with him once or twice, I did not have many strong feelings for him. And I believe it was too soon after Martin's death for me to date seriously. Eventually, he married Duke Ellington's sister, Ruth. He died in 1994. At this stage, just the thought of having someone in my bedroom, where I'm in my 70s, is not something to look forward to. The older you get, the harder it is to adjust to another person in your space. You have to wait on him, too. I waited on Martin hand and foot. He'd step out of his pajamas and leave them right there in the middle of the floor, and I'd pick them up. I'd bring his food to him in bed if he felt like staying in bed. Can you imagine my doing all that now at my age? Imagine two old folks together. I mean, what do you do? Companionship is nice to have, of course, especially if it's the right kind, with no responsibility. But that's not possible. For the most part, my loneliness does not come from being without someone. It comes from being such a visible person. It's hard to go somewhere and not be reminded of who you are, hard to be able to really enjoy yourself. Oftentimes, I didn't go out because I didn't feel like dealing with being a celebrity. To that extent, I feel isolated because I cannot always find things to do that I really can enjoy without being interrupted. As to why my daughters have not married, perhaps the answer lies in how they saw Martin. If you believe that a man like Martin comes along once in a millennium, and you hold other men to the standard of a Martin Luther King Jr., you will not find anyone. That might be what my daughters are coping with. Maybe that's true for me as well. But there's something else, too. Liberated, independent women intimidate some men, and my daughters inherited those traits from me. They own their own things, and there's little that a man can provide for them in that way. And many men like to feel that they can provide things for you, like a home or a car. Men enjoy doing such things for women, but my girls knew Coretta, and Coretta was never a dependent woman. I had to learn to make it as a single parent at an early age. My daughters are just following the example of their mother. How did I encourage this independence? Well, for example, I never bought my children cars. They bought cars when they could afford them. I never wanted to damage my children by letting them depend on me. My mother raised me the same way. I would remember her words. I want you to have an education so you won't have to depend on anybody, including a man. Similarly, I trust that my children and my grandchildren, when they come, will remember what their parents, Martin and Coretta, taught them. To live their best lives, to forgive all quickly, to walk in faith, dignity, and love. I have lived a life beyond anything I ever imagined or thought possible for a child born in Nowhere, USA, into a race that was virtually disqualified from humanity and a gender condemned to silence. It is a life that at the onset felt like the slow dragging gait of the mule trains that would pass my daddy's house on their way to the worksite. Neither man nor beast was in a hurry. No reason to rush. Nothing new to expect. Just the same old steady clippity-clop, day after day. Then, unexpectedly, I was caught up by and thrust into a whirlwind, guided by a force beyond myself and shaped to a purpose I often did not understand until I had to fulfill it. I was not a stranger to trouble. I had been born into troubled and twisted times in the South. Our family home was burned down by white terrorists. But that persecution did not stop my father from pursuing his dreams. And maybe it also planted a seed within me, gave me the strength that prepared me for the future. I understood that I might be killed if I continued alongside Martin and served as his partner in the movement. So I prayed to God for guidance. I asked him to give me the strength to accept his will in my life, even if it meant my death. In my struggle, I also had to learn how to be an activist and a concert artist, a public person in her own right, while also maintaining the roles of minister's wife and mother to my four children. I hope that women can learn from both my mishaps and my successes. Without Martin, I had to find the inner strength to go on. This is a lesson, too. I have known great triumphs. With the help of many, I created the King Center to safeguard and champion Martin's legacy to all the nations as a mecca of spiritual growth and activism. We created a national holiday to commemorate Martin's service and sacrifice and to encourage others to follow in his footsteps. We've spurred redevelopment in Atlanta, creating a citadel of diversity that helped attract the 1996 Summer Olympics and that continues to draw visitors from around the globe. I've met with presidents and prime ministers. I've met great spiritual leaders, including Popes Paul VI and John Paul II, and the Dalai Lama. I've put in time on picket lines and nonviolent protest campaigns for decent wages and working conditions from Memphis to South Carolina to Baltimore. I have spoken at some of the largest peace demonstrations in history in New York City and Bonn, Germany. I participated in the miraculous transformation of an evil system of violence and bigotry that was sapping the humanity from white and black Americans alike. I stand now as a proud daughter of Southern soil, a devoted citizen of the United States, an ambassador of goodwill to the world, and an architect of one of the greatest legacies known to humankind. And along my journey, I found answers to the questions I often pondered when I was that little girl in Alabama. Who will I be? What is my purpose? The answers came little by little, crisis by crisis, trauma by trauma. Like climbing Jacob's ladder, every rung goes higher, higher. If you have a purpose, you have to discover it. Once you discover that purpose, you must follow it. If it's in line with God's will, then I believe you will find fulfillment. When I wasn't praying or in tune with God's will and purpose, I wasn't happy. In contrast, when I was in tune with the will and purpose of God, things may not have gone well, but still I felt good about what I was doing and about myself. My story is one of divine preparation. I was prepared to lead. I was called, and I was chosen. Looking back, I see it so clearly. Meeting Martin was prophetic. It was synergy. It was symphony. Our destinies fused, and we became two souls with one goal. Our union prepared both of us for something larger than either of us could ever have dreamed alone. We became agents of change and servants of one of the most enduring human rights struggles of the 20th century and beyond. Once I found my purpose, I was ready to die to hold on to it. I've never forgotten the motto of the first president of Antioch College, my alma mater. Be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity. Marrying Martin and the movement perfected my journey of discovery, soothed my yearning to pour out the values and vision within my soul. The bombings, the murders, even the assassination of my husband only intensified my devotion and solidified my resolve that God had allowed me to be born at the right time in history, a time when the Spirit tracked down the willing, empowered the waiting, and magnified human outcomes far above what finite minds could conceive. I want people to know that I was committed to leaving an eternal flame built on love that would never be extinguished. I wanted this flame to touch lives, communities, and nations. I wanted it to ignite and inspire. I wanted it to be an urgent call to community and public service. Love is not a program, not a political party, not a race. It is a promise with a power all its own. The contributions of Martin and me and of those behind and before us are the greatest witnesses I can imagine to the power of love in action. When it is time to end this journey, I will count it all joy. Every heartache preceded a breakthrough. Every thorn that pierced me positioned me for the next level of challenges. My story is a freedom song from within my soul. It is a story of struggle. It is about finding one's purpose, a guide to overcoming fear and standing up for causes bigger than one's self. It is a guide to discovery, a vision of how even the worst of human pains and heartaches can be channeled into human monuments, impenetrable and everlasting. Today, though many dreams have been fulfilled down in the valley, we have not yet reached the mountaintop. When all is said and done, is the vision of a beloved community that is part of the World House that Martin and I imagined together within reach? Did we come close to picking up the pieces of the freedom movement scattered across a multiplicity of landscapes and building a model of sacred special shelters for all people? Are we helping to create a foundation of help, hope, and healing? Did we help others learn to work together to end the arms race, prevent environmental catastrophes, and dismantle systems that destroy others based on racial, sexual, or political differences? Are we closer to having a democracy infused with the values of diplomacy, trust, and respect for human life over unchecked militarism, greed, and political hegemony? Have we motivated others to become activists rather than spectators, to take on campaigns to feed the hungry, save the children, and fight poverty and economic exploitation in every nation? Have we inspired others to reach out from within their own comfort zones and build bridges of relationships across economic, political, and class lines? While these may be the right questions, there are no easy answers, and I don't think my generation is the right one to judge. How do you assess a work when its harvest comes from the invisible, the martyred, and the nameless people who allowed those of us with names to be viewed as the leaders of our shared revolution? All I know is that the hour is late, and there is still so much unfinished business. The dream is a work that is very much in progress. I believe my husband's prophetic words are worth repeating and remembering as we go forward. We have a choice today: nonviolent coexistence or violent annihilation within and without our nation. This may be mankind's last chance to choose between chaos and community. I am counting on the next generation to pick up the still broken pieces of society on humanity's Jericho roads and continue the struggle against poverty, greed, and militarism that Martin and I gave our lives to correct. For struggle is a never-ending process, and freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation. I believe future generations will have the courage, the love, and the faith to get this done. This is my hope, and this is my prayer.
This is January Lavoie. We hope you've enjoyed this production of My Life, My Love, My Legacy by Coretta Scott King. This program was produced and directed by Laura Wilson, Scott Sherritt, and Maddie Argyropoulos. Recorded by Maddie Argyropoulos and Richard Seth Abramson. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Text copyright 2017 by the estate of Coretta Scott King. Production copyright 2017 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved. The following are excerpts from archival recordings of Coretta Scott King.
So when I went to high school, which was 9 miles away, that's when my horizons were expanded, and I began to see, understand more about being connected to the larger society and to people outside of my community. The people I met there in the persons of the faculty members were just, you know, tremendous people. They were the kind of people I wanted to become. One of them was my music teacher, and she was my first role model in terms of outside of my family. You know, I've learned to appreciate my parents even more after I grew up. But I realized that she was accomplished in music, and I wanted to be just like her. She could play the piano. She could direct the chorus. She taught us beginning voice class, I guess. It was a whole class that she was having us to vocalize. It's, you know, when you do voice lessons, you go through your vocal exercises. So she was doing that, but as a class, and teaching us posture when you sing, how you stand, and your diction, and those kinds of things. And so, and then she introduced me to the world of classical music. I'd never heard classical music. I was about seventh grade, about 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I just, you know, this is about music. And then she told us about, you know, the great composers, who they were, the great singers, and who were African-American great singers. And when I realized that Paul Robeson, she said, was the world's greatest baritone at that time. Marian Anderson was the world's greatest contralto. And I was thinking, these people are the world's greatest. So that means, you know, I can be something too. I mean, I can achieve. Roland Hayes, you know, was the greatest tenor, you know? Uh-huh. And so, you know, I said, we have all these people, you know, and because I liked music so much, and I said, well, that's what started me thinking about music as a career option. And others who were white, who had come to us, who were Quakers, I mean, they said, we are Friends, American Friends Service Committee. I heard about them. I mean, it's like being introduced to all these things that were national in scope. And then when Bayard Rustin came to the school when I was ninth grade, and he spoke about the Indian independence struggle in Gandhi, and I'm thinking, I never heard of that before, but I knew it, studying, you know, my history, and I knew something about, you know, that India was a country, and I guess I knew that it was, I'm not sure whether I fully understood the political situation there, but when he talked about the British and the Indians and how the British beat them to a pulp, and Gandhi's salt march to the sea took place, and all this, and so all of this exposure broadened my understanding of the world, and I wanted to start thinking about, I want to be the kind of person who can be comfortable wherever I am in the world, and I got to get the best education possible. It means I got to go on. And my mother had told me I was going to college, so I knew I was going, and I wanted to go. Because I was always, the head of my class. I mean, the leading student in my class. We were in the elementary school. So I graduated valedictorian of my class, but I only had 18 in my class, so it wasn't, it's like a little mm-hmm. pond, and I was
the big fish in the pond.
But anyway, so then when I went to Antioch, now here, this is where my horizons were expanded even further, because you meet people of all different races and all cultures and religions, and you get to know that they're just people like you are, and so that because Antioch had that sense of community, that spirit of, everybody seemed to have liked everybody, loved everybody. I mean, I understood the meaning of the beloved community because you had that sense that you belong there. I mean, even though we were African Americans and we had not lived with white people in dormitories, we had been with white people as teachers who were very concerned about us and who were very loving and very supportive. And we knew that they were concerned about our well-being, our welfare. And they encouraged us to go on and to be our best selves, as my parents did, of course, that started at home. But at Antioch, I saw the fruition of all this is what the larger society ought to be about. I mean, the way people treat each other, the way we interact with each other. You had to be knowledgeable about the issues of the day, but they were being discussed. That was a very stimulating environment. All of the books, the latest books that were being talked about, read, they were discussed on the campus. So even if you didn't read them, you knew what they were about. Mm-hmm. And so you would be inclined to go try to read. And so I said, this is a great place, not only and I learned about art, because I had to take all this, I had to study, my courses in art, and literature, and philosophy, and, I mean, just all of the discipline. I mean, I had to also do remedial stuff because I had not had the preparation.
Yeah, I mean, as long as I ran it through him, and almost never, he almost always, encouraged me to do more than what I would, I would have done if I had decided, well, no, maybe I shouldn't do this. I've been traveling too much. I mean, I shouldn't do this. Because I wanted him to be comfortable with it. The other thing I think is true, Martin was fine with me doing things as long as I didn't enjoy it too much. Because he said to me one day, you are not satisfied just being mm-hmm. my wife and the mother of my children.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, so you have to excel in the exterior. And I said, well, I love being the wife of your wife and the mother of your children, but if that was all that I did, I would go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
He had this ambivalence, that's what I want to say, because he would want me to do these things. But he also wanted me to be at home, mm-hmm. too. I mean, it was a very strange thing, mm-hmm. how he would say, okay, you need to do this, but then the next week he'd say, well, you need to take care of the children and you need to spend more time, and then something would come. He'd say, no, you need to do this. You need to get somebody to keep your children. I'd say, well, what is it you really want me to do? I mean, I'd be glad to do whatever it is you want me to do. But he couldn't make up his mind, you know, because I really genuinely think that he felt that I could supplement what he was doing and it could make a difference. And he sort of felt like, okay, well, her being there also helps, mm-hmm. the cause, and it advances the cause as well. And she's a, you know, an intelligent woman, and she has something to say, and I think it's that she should be allowed to say it. I think he really felt that way. But if he thought that I was enjoying this more than I accepted my responsibility as wife and mother, I think it would have been really hard for me. She went to Smith College and she majored in theater arts. One of the things that I was hoping that she did do when she went to college, that she would be feel that she had to be a you know, she had to fight all the battles, and she had to be the integration leader. Now, there needed to be somebody doing something then, because by the time she went to Smith, colleges in the North were resegregating themselves. And I went up to Smith and found out that all the students, the black students, ate in one little area, white students, other. They lived in separate dormitories. I mean, it just was, and I said, you know, I fought the battle of integration back in, you know, the 40s. I mean, I went to college in 45. And I fought that battle, and I thought we had fought it once and for all. But now, you know, and this is 72 to 76, and so it was, you know, same battle all over again. But I did not want her to feel that she had to be out there because of who she was. So I really did not push it, because I know that was, you know, she had, that was something that if she decided that's what she wanted to do, fine. But I did not want to push her in that direction. So she finished Smith College. And she graduated with honors. And she enrolled in NYU, got her master's in fine arts from NYU. And of course, it was tough because drama school, when they have you in graduate school, they really try to break you. I mean, if they can't break you, then...
Context of white supremacy. They ended the audio abruptly. That was not Gus T. It was not, you know, sterling HD quality recording, but that was the late Mrs. Coretta Scott King. So we are all done. It will be a new book next Friday. As I said, if I was just picking one, I would go with Gil Scott Heron's autobiography, which is called The Last Holiday. As I said, it would be a nice follow to this, because he also was involved in the effort to get a federal King holiday, and his autobiography is focused on that. That is a major theme, but it also goes through his life and what growing up was like. And he was someone who's devoted a lot of his life and time talking about racism. His book is a lot about racism. And I am a big fan of Gil Scott Heron. I think it's almost amazing. We've been on the air almost a decade and we have never really done a program dedicated to him. So if I was just going to pick one, that would be my choice, The Last Holiday, Gil Scott Heron. But if folks have another choice, another selection, I know Pound of Flesh was also recommended. That was, I'm not going to say the name because I'll mess it up, but it just came out this year, black female, or within the last like 7 months, black female, great book. And it's about the history of using black corpses, kind of reminds me a lot of medical apartheid, but that was recommended as well. But, you know, whatever, you can think of that next Friday. I'll let people know definitively by Tuesday. If you have commentary, the number to dial 641-715-3640. Code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. I just want to check really quick to make sure there are not new hands that I'm missing. Okay, it looks like I don't see any new hands at the moment, so I'll keep an eye out. If there are folks who have a final comment that you want to get in before we wrap this book up, make sure you get your hand up. Do not wait till the last moment. Everybody who dialed in who has a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to share your thoughts.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard again?
Yes, sir.
Wow. I'm going to be honest on how I was thinking as I was hearing the last segment. I can almost hear in the background, "Lift every voice and sing," and "We shall overcome." In the background, behind that, what I thought was almost like a recital of quote unquote accomplishments. And, you know, I would say VGQ, from the mere standpoint, is that the global system of racism and white supremacy, which is what I think is what her husband was killed attempting to neutralize, is a very serious thing. So any efforts that we put towards it, you know, first of all, it's realizing that white people have been warring against the world and everybody else in it who is not white. And once you become a conscious participant into trying to neutralize, you don't have time to sit back and look at quote unquote accomplishments. You know, and the war is still being waged. So those are just my thoughts on it. You know, as far as that concern on what, you know, I accomplished, but what has not been accomplished is an answer to the problem. Sorry about that for me thinking in that way. But that's where I'm just being honest. That's where my mind is at as far as that concern. Yeah, I like the idea of Gil Scott-Heron, because I'm reminded of how, Nina Simone, who literally transformed their thoughts on music into like an instrument to, like I say, once again, attempt to neutralize the global system of racist white supremacy. There's an excellent documentary on Miss Simone, and I haven't really seen an extensive one on Gil Scott-Heron, but I certainly like yourself and listened to his music over, you know, I don't know, since he made his first music to the end, and it's always been in that light in some way, form, or fashion. And so, you know, I mean, whatever tool, in other words, what it's showing to me, whatever tool that one has, you know, you should be trying to utilize that to do something constructive, and also it's geared towards finding a way to neutralize the system of racism by experience. So I'm all for it with Gil Scott-Heron. Thank you.
Right on, retired firefighter. Other folks have commentary. Again, concluding thoughts, major themes of the book, takeaways, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, Red.
I guess omitting the first segment of this reading, I feel like others have said, there's definitely a lot of white validation, and I was just trying to figure out like why was there so much of that, because she still, you know, did see so much blatant racism, much more than I guess what a black person today would see. Besides, of course, all the killings, she actually had the bombings and so forth, and even the assassination. And so I was thinking, I remember in the beginning of the book, she had said something about either her mother or her grandmother was German, and just kind of thinking in that frame of mind, if, you know, with the tragic mulatto, so on and so forth, to kind of trying to figure out why was there just so much of the, you know, will this white person help me? And then just hearing other people's suggestions about, I guess I can kind of understand, you know, even if another non-white person had done something that might have been incorrect, how there was like a little bit more explanation and about it in the book. The one thing that was kind of troubling to me at the end was just as typical, and I don't blame her, but definitely putting two things together, like racism with sexism, and even people with political differences, which I've been hearing that more lately, especially with the whole Russia thing. But that was a little troubling. But I definitely appreciate, you know, just finding out more things about her. I feel like with this book, it at least took her, with me, it at least took her out of the only position of being Dr. Martin Luther King's wife, and that's it. Because, of course, in the school system, I was in public school, we didn't hear about her and her participation in the marches, and, you know, just even with the committees. And I understand, you know, with the King Center and with the holiday, even though those weren't, those didn't necessarily help with the system of white supremacy, but that was something that was never mentioned. I didn't even know, like, why. You know, with me being more confused, just thought that, hey, white people, they decided to give Dr. Martin Luther King a holiday because they finally realized how great of a person he was. That was when I was more confused, but it definitely, I felt like that book definitely helped make her into, or it definitely helped me to see her as her own person. That's all I wanted to add. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Other folks have commentary they want to get in. While you all are thinking, listener, she wrote in, she's written in before. She says, I found it interesting that Mrs. King, having gone so hard with this holiday for her husband, that she would then turn around and allow her underage daughter to play the role of a prostitute and kissing a white boy. This is from last week's segment. The implications are there that she, in her role, not only kisses but engages in other intimate activities. I understand wanting to give your children the opportunity to make their own mistakes, but I did not see where this choice would honor her daughter, Mrs. King, or her husband. It wasn't television where that image of her hyper-sexualized black female is prevalent, but there may have been some write-up about the play in local newspapers. What a shame neither daughter or mother could see how damaging this was for non-white people, especially those who claim so-called Christianity, to read her book and see those so-called Christian morals discarded. There were moments where I cringed when Mrs. King spoke about Dr. Henry Kissinger, who won the Nobel Peace Prize. This is the same racist suspect who worked as President Nixon's National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. I might be mistaken, but Mrs. King did write about how Nixon despised her husband. I would think that as Nixon's National Security Advisor, he would have certainly advised Nixon on how to handle Dr. King. Another moment that made me cringe was when she was used by George Bush and his wife by having her sit in full view during, I believe, a speech given by Bush during his campaign. Indeed, I used the photograph from them sitting together for one of the event images on Facebook and Twitter. Making mostly, I am sure, non-white people question not Bush's motives, but Mrs. King's. I think she talked about that in the book where she mentions this episode. I liked that she gave the readers an opportunity to get to know a little bit about her children. I could be wrong in the way I'm seeing this, but she seems to speak with more affection and compassion towards her daughters and more harshly about her sons. But again, it could just be the way I'm interpreting her words. No discourtesy towards Mrs. King, just my opinion, the way I see it. Big ups to Mr. Richard Williams, who, by the way, suffered a stroke in 2016. From one of our listeners. Did anybody get that impression that she showed more affection, I think is the term she uses, more affection towards her daughters and spoke more harshly about her sons? Did anyone get that impression?
I personally didn't notice it.
I can, I wouldn't say harshly, but I do understand where she did kind of provide more details about her daughters, especially with the, like we just talked about, the one who was in the play and the other one who, I'm sorry, forgetting the names, who did go in to start preaching. It's like with her sons, I kind of felt like she only basically spoke about them briefly when it came to the King Center. And even like, I think the youngest one, was it Bunny, who was, seemed a little bit less confused when she was younger as far as when her father passed. So I can kind of see where she talked about them more, but I'm not sure as far as being more harsh when it came to her sons.
The children, Dexter, Martin III, Bernice, Yolanda, the four children. I guess five is the King Center, the way she lays it out in the book. Anybody else want to comment on that? If they, I didn't notice a difference per se in more affection. I didn't notice that per se. Anybody else?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I don't think it's harsh, but like the last caller just said, I think that she went more into details with the daughters. I personally think that she did that because the daughters were more of a connection to Martin, especially when she went back to saying how Bunny, when she was young, how Martin would ask her to like kiss different places of the face, and then she kept emphasizing like all the women kissed on various places of his face, but he never really mentioned, like he only mentioned the boys kissing his cheeks, but the more sentimental part of it was more of where she placed her lips on Martin and where the daughters had placed their lips around his mouth too. So I think they went into details with that, especially when, you know, he said with the children, putting them on the fridge and they dive off into his hand. So I felt like she really emphasized more on that. And with the part about the interaction with the white boy in the play, I felt like she gave her more leeway because remember when she was younger, she actually interacted and had a interracial dating back in her early experience. So I felt like she wanted to have like a connection with her daughter and didn't want to be like, okay, you can't do this, but then the daughter would be like, hey, you did that, so why can't I do that? So I felt like she was just trying to give her some fair leeway and not be a hypocrite about it. But that's all I have.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. Anybody else have commentary, final thoughts they want to get in as we conclude My Life, My Love, My Legacy?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. For my final thoughts, I think one of the things that I picked up from the book, I guess the way that racism, white supremacy uses every aspect of victims in their fight for the system. So as they utilize her husband, and then I think about how the feminist movement used her during the period to Martin's rise, and then the notoriety of Martin, and then toward the end, after he passed, then they kind of propped Mrs. King up in many different levels. And I think as I look at the Black feminist movement now, and I am no expert, I'm still learning on all the things that are happening, but as I look at the Black feminist movement and even some of the pieces that we heard in the later clip, it just sounds like all of the rhetoric that I hear and some of the same tones about she not being able to do this, to do that, and it just sounds so reminiscent of what I'm hearing kind of like in today's Black feminist movement. And I think looking at the book and just thinking about Antioch Colleges and Smith College and all the female-based colleges and how a lot of the programming, and I've done a lot of recruiting on some of those campuses, but it just seems like the system kind of just utilized the King family in so many ways, even the King Center, in the efforts. Like, they went from what their father was doing to kind of like all these things that really, and again, I don't want to take anything away from what other victims were doing to make the system better, but it just seemed like they were doing things that weren't really addressing the fight for getting rid of the injustice of the entire system. They're kind of like when I look at, you know, organizations, sororities and fraternities, the Lynx organization that they talked about, and, you know, demonizing her for missing a meeting. And here we are dealing with racism, white supremacy. So all of these organizations, people within the government not really doing anything. So the book just kind of showed me today, back then, the system utilizes the people that they prop up and continue to utilize them until they don't need them anymore and they just discard them. So good reading. Happy that we're kind of at this place, but definitely informative and constructive read overall. I'll mute my line.
Glad I stuck with it. I learned. Anybody else have a commentary they want to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I was giving it just a little bit more thought about if she showed any more affection towards anyone, sex of her children. And from the reading, I couldn't see that. But I do see her showing a lot more affection towards the King Center, which I felt early on in the text when she began to mention it and kept calling it her baby. And I do understand that as like part of your creation, you know, but it was a bit much, I think, the many times that she called the King Center her baby and all the different metaphors. And I would be really interested to, you know, to know if her children felt like they had to take a back seat or any kind of thing about the King Center. But that was just something. My final takeaways from the text just emphasize how important having a functional definition of racism, white supremacy is, really knowing who and what these white people are and placing them in proper context, the extent of our brain trashing, brainwashing, and just confusion about everything, even where we are and what time it is and who we are, because I didn't know a lot about Ms. King before the text, but I knew, you know, her being Dr. King's wife, felt that, you know, she's just automatically kind of one of the greats no matter what. not knowing all that she did, even after his death. But after listening to the text and participating in the study of the text, it also kind of made me feel a little less, it just took away the glitter and glam, I think, of it, if I'm going to just be frank about it. It just made these people very, very human, very regular, very confused. No difference in me or anything like that. Just, and to help clear out from my own confusion, how come certain things don't work and won't work. So I'm happy that there was a Dr. King and a Mrs. King, and that they did what they did, said what they said, and lived their lives the way that they did. Because for me, what that does is kind of cross off that as a possibility. Does nonviolent dogma work to replace the system of white supremacy with justice? No, scratch it off the list. And I think that's what I'm most grateful for, because I think when I look at things from a scientific point, or I just try to be logical about things, it's important to have different methods of testing out if something will work or not. And I was able to see that that doesn't. And I think that that's really fantastic, in addition to learning some of the other information that I just did not know. So it's highlighted my own ignorance. I think I'm complete with that. Thank you.
Grand, appreciate that. Emmy, Dr. Kamal Kamban, on one of his earlier visits when talking about Dr. King, he said almost that exact same statement. He said he has great admiration for Dr. King, and he also looks at Dr. King's life and work and what he sacrificed for. It shows, well, this is not going to work. You know, this is exactly as you stated. This is one we can cross off the list. Best illustration that we could possibly have for, as you said, you know, being dogmatic, and let's be nonviolent and see if somehow we can morally persuade white folks to do right. No. All right, moving on to next strategy. Other folks, or actually, before I even get other folks, I have the ebook, right? I suspect that if you get the hard copy of the text, it will probably have some of these additional afterwards in the text from the actual text. There was a lot of rhetoric, I thought, down the stretch, which I just, you know, am not a fan of. But she said, have we motivated others to become activists rather than spectators to take on campaigns to feed the hungry, save the children, and fight poverty and economic exploitation in every nation? And I thought that was so important because we have the system of white supremacy motivates black people to be spectators. I say that all the time. Got to be active, particularly with application of counter-racism concepts. We have to be active, not just spectators. To the afterward. So there are afterwards by many different people in after the actual text. So Andrew Young, former mayor of Atlanta, he writes, Coretta was gracious but stronger than the men around her ever wanted her to be. Remember, this was the 50s. We men thought we were going to rule the roost, and our women would stay home, have babies, and bake cookies. Coretta wanted a family and a career, and she did achieve both and excelled at both. She was a real hands-on mom, despite all the other assignments she took upon herself. I think her toughness came from her father. Her daddy, Obi, was one of the coolest men I have ever known. He was not polished. He was not articulate. He wasn't a speaker. But he was a powerful, well-respected man who built up a business, watched white residents of Heiberger, Alabama, destroy it, and still had the strength to go on and start another business and not hate anybody. Andrew Young. Next. Let's see. So this is from the late Dr. Maya Angelou. She writes, Dr. King was killed on my birthday, April 4th, 1968. I was devastated. Coretta and I grieved together, literally falling into each other's arms. And we remained that close
the rest of her life. Coretta would come and stay with me occasionally at my home in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Once I shared a book with her that was written about sisters. I have a sister and a brother that are blood relatives, but my chosen sister is Maya, who makes me laugh, she'd say. She also used to say that Martin told her she didn't laugh enough and that she should go be around Maya. Stop there. These folks wrote extensively, right? They wrote like a page or two of commentary. I'm just trying to pick out a paragraph or two that stood out. Representative John Conyers, who has written consistently for years the bill for reparations for black people, he wrote, remember, we did not have a black woman in Congress until 1968 with the election of New York Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm. Although we'd elected a white woman, Jeanette Rankin, in 1916, Coretta's reach was extensive both horizontally and vertically. The whole time Coretta carried herself with such dignity, she was never involved in any kind of scandal. She carried a great moral authority. We always felt she spoke for right at the right time. Her presence in political circles helped us men move beyond gendered traditions. U.S. Representative John Conyers, Jr. Any other concluding thoughts? Folks want to make sure they get in before we wrap up. Wait a minute. Merle Evers Williams, widow of Medgar Evers, she wrote, Coretta, Betty Shabazz, and I were a threesome. The public perception fanned by the media was that we were jealous and competitive. In reality, we three had lost our husbands, the loves of our lives. What about that was something to be in competition over? How foolish. People don't understand what it's like to bear the weight of being the wife of, the widow of. The perception is that there was no difference of opinion between you and your husband. You just went along with his views. And that was simply not so. Coretta was strong-willed. Her ability to persuade people, to bring them around to her way of thinking, or to intervene behind the scenes was tremendous. I recall when I was chairman of the NAACP and there was much debate over whether or not I should receive the Springarn Medal, one of the highest honors. This was in 1998. The opposition argued that since my late husband, civil rights activist Medgar Evers, had received it, I couldn't. We were in the same family and it would break protocol. Man, oh man, the things we can end up arguing over. A trinket named after a racist suspect on the slave ship. Wow. I said I disagree. My husband, who was the NAACP field secretary in Jackson, Mississippi, gave his life as chairman of the national organization. I picked us up and helped us move forward. I want, deserve, and demand the Springer. Then I called Coretta and she asked me what I wanted her to do. Nothing, I said. And she goes on to talk about how Coretta vigorously went on to defend for her to get this Springer Award. And again, this is named after some race. So anyway, these are all included in the text. And she goes on to have a line or two more. And I wanted to make sure I include this just because I often hear a lot of anti-blackness directed at Oprah Winfrey for a variety of reasons, for what she has done, what she hasn't done, talking about racism, not talking about racism, white people, whatever. This is a longer one. Dr. Bernice King, one of the children, obviously. So she just a quick point. She says, Mom was invited to Oprah's 50th birthday party cruise, and boy, did she have a blast. Usually, when she returned from one of those events, she would be laughing almost giddy like a schoolgirl. Because she was with other well-known famous people, she didn't have to feel like she was on display. The condo that Oprah secured for her in Atlanta was also right on time, such a blessing. It was clear that once she had the stroke in 2005, she could not have remained at our home in Vine City. The steps were a barrier, and it would have been extremely difficult to make the house wheelchair accessible because of the way it was built. The condo, which had an elevator, provided her a place where she could feel well cared for and every morning awaken to a beautiful sunrise. Just black self-respect for Oprah Winfrey. I think for someone that I often hear a lot of bad people, a lot of black people talk badly about, for her to do something to look out for another black person. Bravo. Bravo. Any final thoughts folks need to get in?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just real quick. 2 points that I wanted to point out that I think was real powerful for me in the book. She says, "We walk and walk where Martin would have walked and worked if he had been allowed to live." And I feel like to this day it still resonates that whites feel like they are allowing us to live. And at any minute they feel like they have the choice to take our lives. And I think that was very powerful. And another one is, shortly after the funeral, I had to go to the bank to transact some business, and it was the first time I left home without Bunny. As I walked past the door, she called out to me, "Mommy, don't go, don't go. You may get shot." Her cries jarred me as I said, "Look, I promise nothing is going to happen to Mommy." And that just, it just really hits me because a lot of our black people, we leave our homes with our children and end up being a hashtag on the news. So I felt like those are two very powerful points in the book. And I love the book. I enjoyed it. And thanks again, Gustin. Thanks again, Carlos. Appreciate it.
Right on. I remember that, I believe, from last week about when she was talking about her children, when she said that was the response. Don't go. You could get shot. And I think she told her, nothing's going to happen to me. And I think even for just a typical black person, that is kind of a dicey proposition to just assert, you know, to declare, "Oh, nothing's going to happen to me. I'm just going to get some Skittles and iced tea," or, you know, whatever, whatever you think it is that you're going to do, and you're going to get that and return home safely. But they were threatened all the time. That's all that had been her whole life. Bombings and terrorist attacks here and shootings and assassinations like that. That is a lot of times we are faced with that dilemma to tell our children, to tell people that we care about, to tell ourselves the truth about, you know, how dangerous the world is. And, you know, white people might not allow me to even, you know, walk 5 feet outside the house. They might not even allow that. With that, everybody satisfied? Indeed. Hope folks got something constructive from the text. I learned, not on my top 10 book list, but I definitely learned quite a bit. Coretta Scott King, My Life, My Love, My Legacy. As I said, if I was just picking, it would be Gil Scott Heron, The Last Holiday. And again, great follow-up. I'd say great choice, because a lot of it is focused on his efforts to help secure a National King holiday. I'm pretty sure Coretta Scott King would have to be mentioned in there somewhere, but that would be my choice. If folks have a better selection or what have you, let me know. I'll make sure to decide by Tuesday. So if you want to get the book, you can do so. I'm not quite sure about the availability of this text. Like, if this is one you can easily, like, go to your local library and it'll be there. I'm not sure. I'll check on that and see, but that kind of would be the way that I'm leaning. I'll let people know for sure. So you can go ahead and check now if you want to have a hard copy in hand for next Friday. With that, compensatory call-in tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll review news, observations, last 7 days. If you have counter-racist suggestions or just thoughts you want to share, tune in. We'll be looking forward to hearing from folks. Thanks for everyone who has participated in the book study session. Hope it was worthy of your Friday evening. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know the weather is great. It was a beautiful day out here in Seattle. Hung outside, got some sun,
lovely. You do not, even under these wonderful circumstances, you do not want to lax in your codification. Racists don't pause for nice weather. You do not want to be out and about, going to the beach or whatever else you're doing, intoxicated and end up being stopped, confronted by a race soldier, badge or no. Your life could be over in the next 5 minutes easily. You being intoxicated makes that situation way worse. I've seen no evidence that us being under the influence is going to help us neutralize safely an encounter with Daniel Holdsclaw, Darren Wilson, Betty Shelby, any of these other whites. Again, badge or no, sobriety would be best. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.